call the hearing to order. The chairman notes the presence of a quorum. Clerk will note the roll. Representative Wardlow will move the minutes of the March 5th meeting of the House Civil Law Committee. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Holberg, House File 2798, that will note for members of the committee and for those with us here today the ground rules for today's discussion. Beginning, Representative Holberg will control 20 minutes to present in favor of House File 2798. Mr. Groot will control 20 minutes to speak in opposition to the bill. I will note for both of you that should you not consume your full 20 minutes, you may reserve the remainder of that time to yourselves to make closing remarks before we take the vote. Next, we will receive 30 minutes of public testimony in favor of the bill, and then 30 minutes of public testimony in opposition to the bill. I would note for those of you who are scheduled to testify today, these blocks of time, so if you're towards the front, please be mindful of your time, because there are those who will follow behind you who will have to use the remainder of that time. So please be mindful of that. After 30 minutes of public testimony in favor and opposition, we will move to 20 minutes of committee discussion that will include time to consider any amendments. I note for members of the committee that we will not receive questions or entertain questions from the committee for testifiers until this time, in the interest of time management. Finally, I would remind everyone in the room today that we do have rules of conduct and rules of decorum here. No outbursts of any kind will be tolerated today, clapping, cheering, jeering, laughter, or anything of that nature. If anyone insists on disrupting the proceedings today, you will be asked to leave by security, so I appreciate your cooperation in that manner. The chair recognizes Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I would like to move House File 2798 for consideration before the committee.
Representative Holberg, it's my understanding that you would move that this bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Proceed.
Thank you. Committee members and members of the audience, the bill that is before us today is pretty straightforward and rather brief. It simply allows the voters of the state of Minnesota to vote on a very important issue that is coming before us at this time. It would define the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman, and that no other relationship would be recognized as its legal equivalent. This is very similar to the Defense of Marriage Act, which is commonly referred to as DOMA, which 39 states have now passed, as well as the federal government, which passed in 1997 with the support of President Clinton and then-Senator Wellstone. In addition, in 1997, the state of Minnesota passed a DOMA amendment, which became a DOMA bill, which became part of the law. And in the DFL-controlled House, it was passed with 105 votes. And in the Senate, also DFL-controlled, it was included in an omnibus health bill with 54 votes in favor. That law has stood on our books since that time. And in addition, as I mentioned, a number of states, 39, had passed DOMA into statute. We also have what some refer to as super DOMAs, in that four of the 50 states have put this defense of marriage, or a definition of marriage, into their state constitution. Those states being Nebraska, Alaska, Nevada, and Hawaii, which Hawaii also put in statute a reciprocal benefit relationship, which is a contractual relationship that they recognize as an alternative relationship to marriage. As you're all aware, this issue was probably brought to more light given the Massachusetts State Supreme Court decision in November of this year, and shortly thereafter, Senator Bachman and myself announced our intention to bring this issue before the voters of the state of Minnesota to decide. Colette, Professor Colette, who's with me today, will get more into some of the legal details of these issues. But what we see happening is this issue is exploding across the country. And according to a report by it's posted on stateline.org, currently 35 states have introduced legislation this year that aims at preserving the traditional definition of marriage as a union between a man and a woman. And we also have seen a number of court challenges and a number of jurisdictions issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Currently, Utah has passed, they will have a constitutional amendment on their ballot this fall. Wisconsin last week endured a 14-hour floor session on this issue, and it passed through their state assembly and is, to my knowledge, scheduled to be acted on in their Senate tomorrow. The state of Michigan today at 1 o'clock was beginning to take up this issue. And so, members, it's pretty clear to me that the state is becoming more and more engaged in this issue. Many of you have received emails. I have two stacks of emails in front of me here at the stand, which unfortunately are not a full representation of the number of emails, because since Sunday night I haven't had the opportunity to sort and print any additional ones, but there's hundreds more that are sitting on my screen waiting to be put into the piles. This is a issue in which it's fundamental to our society and should not be determined through judicial action, where seven state Supreme Court justices will make this very, very important decision for the residents of the state of Minnesota. And that is why I bring this bill before you today, so that this is the first step in bringing this issue before the voters in November, so the voters can say, have their say in this very important issue. And at this time, I'd like to turn my time over to Professor Collette.
Professor Collette, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. And I have copies of my written testimony, Mr. Chairman, which are more extensive than I expect my oral remarks to be made for the committee. Mr. Chairman, my name is Teresa Collette. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. I'm a member of the American Law Institute, and I've testified before the United States House of Representatives and seven other state legislatures. I testified in January before this very committee when it was considering whether or not there was a need for legislative action related to marriage. Since that time, Mr. Chairman, there has been a remarkable and dramatic change in the current state of this question. The current attack on the law concerning marriage has accelerated at an unprecedented pace. As I noted in January, there were three states at that time defending its law on marriage. At that time, the states that were defending its law on marriage were, in fact, the states of New Jersey, Indiana, and Arizona. Since that time, the mayor in San Francisco has made the unilateral decision to issue marriage licenses, and according to Mayor Newsom and his actions, there have been over 3,600 marriage licenses issued in that state. That's reflected in my written testimony on page 5. In New Mexico, a county clerk, relying on the opinion of a county attorney, began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples in that state, and she issued 66 marriage licenses. A mayor in New York determined that that state's constitution mandated the issuances of licenses, and he issued 25 licenses. Attorney General Spitzer disagreed, and Mayor West has since stopped issuing licenses pending a meeting with the Attorney General of that state. However, he has said that he intends to continue issuing licenses after that meeting. On May 5th, a gay couple filed suit in New York City alleging the unconstitutionality of that state laws. Of greatest concern, however, are the actions of the officials in a county in Oregon. In Oregon, county officials determined that the Oregon state law did not address the nature of the applicants for marriage licenses. And so they determined that they should issue licenses to same-sex couples. Over 3,000 marriage licenses have now issued in Oregon to same-sex couples. A lawsuit was filed to enjoin this conduct, and just yesterday, a trial court refused a temporary restraining order to the plaintiffs seeking to stop that conduct in order that a reasoned political decision could be made in that particular case. In West Virginia, in Florida, in Nebraska, and in Washington, lawsuits have been filed challenging those laws as well. The lawsuit in Florida, according to press reports published in the gay news outlets, indicate that the plaintiffs were recruited in gay bars. In other words, in the mere 6 weeks since this committee last took testimony on this issue, the states having to defend their marriage laws have multiplied almost four times. This is not an issue that can be ignored. It is clear that sometime in the near future, a state official in Minnesota is going to have to respond to the assertion that a couple in Minnesota is entitled to a marriage license. Minnesota Public Radio reports that at least one of the couples from San Francisco obtaining a marriage license under the order of Mayor Newsom was a Minnesota couple. That marriage license could very well be presented to a Minnesota state official at any point in time with the demand that Minnesota officials recognize it as valid under Minnesota law, bringing the Minnesota statute's constitutionality into question. So the question then becomes, what should we do? Now, at the last hearing, there was a fundamental question that was presented by testimony on both sides. Why is the state in the marriage business? And there are some radical commentators that appear in the press and in the law journals that suggest that the answer to this conflict that we're seeing engulf the nation is to simply get the state out of the marriage business. I suggest that that's the wrong answer. In fact, I believe that the reason the state is in the marriage business is to channel reproductive conduct into permanent, exclusive relationships. The reason the state is interested in channeling reproductive conduct into permanent, exclusive relationships is because that is the only conduct that creates the vulnerability of women and children. And there is a growing consensus that children do best when they are raised by their biological parents in a married union. In fact, we are finding that no other substitute does as well, despite the heroic efforts of single parent families and step families. Now, some may argue that this is an overly restrictive view of the nature of civil marriage, and opponents would point to the fact that there is no test for a marriage license concerning the fertility of couples, unlike Prince Charles, who demanded to know the status of Princess Di prior to the entry of the marriage. There is no state obligation. But in fact, under Minnesota law, as it used to be the law in every other state in the union, a marriage license can be set aside if the couple does not engage in the marital act. Why is that? Because what the state is interested in regulating is the procreative function. What we're concerned about is ensuring that children are protected by being raised in, ideally, a permanent monogamous union. It is often answered to this argument that, in fact, the state allows infertile couples or couples who intend to contracept to marry. Well, intention doesn't determine fertility. In fact, according to the Minnesota Department of Health, depending on age, approximately one-third to three-quarters of all pregnancies in this state are unintended. In fact, most of us can confirm this by our own personal experience with oops babies, either our own or those of our friends. It is appropriate, indeed necessary, to encourage any couples having heterosexual sexual experiences to marry in order to achieve the objective of encouraging childbearing within marriage. That is one of the major health goals of this state, to discourage out-of-wedlock childbearing. As to young and fertile couples, the state has a legitimate concern not to intrude on those couples' privacy. And as to the elderly, the modeling that we achieve by ensuring that those couples model permanent monogamous unions is important, because young couples who see those couples in everyday affairs don't know if they've been married 30 minutes or 30 years. That's the state's interest. Same-sex couples advocate that, in fact, the state's interest is not procreation, but rather its mutual commitment. I agree that there are many same-sex couples that do indeed have mutual commitment and enduring affection. I don't dispute that. But that is not, in my opinion, a legitimate interest of the state. I do not want the state in the business of issuing love licenses. I think the state's legitimate interest, rather, is ensuring that men and women who engage in acts that create the vulnerability of children stay together and raise those children to the extent that we can induce them to do so. Because same-sex couples, by their actions, do not create children, they are not within the ambit of those laws. Now, it is possible to define marriage independent of marital acts. But if we do that, how will we go about doing so? By the fact that they live together? Well, so do roommates. So how do we exclude those people? By the fact that they have a common participation in the affairs of life? Well, so do religious communities. So how do we do that? The definitional problems are enormous. They are beyond being solved. Finally, I would note the problems that we have in reaching a consensus without damaging the religious freedoms of others, and we need only look at the experience of foreign countries. The morality of sexual acts between same-sex partners is deeply contested in this country, notwithstanding Lawrence v. Texas. Lawrence v. Texas, the United States Supreme Court on the Texas sodomy law, is premised on the privacy rights of those individuals and does not mandate public acceptance of those acts, unlike a public mandate of marriage. What we see in those foreign countries that mandates public acceptance is a growing totalitarianism against religious communities that do not accept the legitimacy of same-sex acts. In Canada, there have been the imposition of criminal fines against those who have published just citation to Bible verses in opposition to same-sex conduct. In Ireland, the Irish Civil Liberties Union threatened Catholic priests and bishops for distribution of a Vatican document that characterized homosexual acts as evil. In Spain, a Spanish cardinal who delivered a sermon against same-sex marriage has been sued by a Spanish gay rights group. In England, an English pastor was attacked for carrying a sign, again, that simply cited, not quoted, Bible verses condemning homosexual conduct, and was denied the defense of self-defense when he was, in fact, prosecuted for his response to his attackers. And in Sweden, a pastor has been charged with hate speech for a sermon condemning homosexual acts. The issue is not about tolerance. It's about affirmation. What is necessary is to allow the people to make this critical decision about how we order our common lives. The issue is coming to Minnesota. Let me respond to the argument that the state constitution is not intended to be amended in such a manner. Our constitution directs the action of all government officials. As such, it is an agreement between the people and their representatives regarding the way the people's business is to be conducted. In the past, it has not been necessary to address the nature of marriage because of a societal consensus that marriage was about family formation. Today, we have differing views in society, and we must choose. That is the reality of our situation. Either the state will continue to regulate marriage out of concern for the well-being of the formation of the family, or it will be viewed as a means of individual fulfillment. In making this choice, either the people will give meaning and structure to our political order through the process of political debate and democratic voting, or will be imposed by us on us by lawyers and judicial fiat. While I am a member of the lawyer class, I do not believe that such a basic issue of how we order our common lives together should be controlled by what Tocqueville characterized as the aristocracy of America. Rather, I believe it should be decided over the dinner tables and lunch counters and water coolers of this great state. And I urge you, as members of the legislature, to let the people vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Collette. Thank you, Representative Holberg. The chair will now recognize Ms. DeGroot. Ms. DeGroot, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Again, the chair will recognize you for 20 minutes of testimony. If you would please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ann DeGroot. I'm the executive director of Outfront Minnesota. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, for inviting us here today to testify in opposition to House File 2798, which is the Minnesota Anti-Marriage Amendment. I have with me today two...
Mr. Grudem, if I could interrupt for a moment, could you move closer to a microphone, please? I'm afraid the tape isn't going to pick up your testimony.
Yeah, okay. Is that going to work?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. I brought with me today two speakers who will talk during my 20-minute time. Professor Mary Jane Morrison from Hamline University Law School and Robert Sikora, who is a Minneapolis attorney. But before they speak, I'd like to make a few comments. First of all, just a reminder that what we're talking about here is civil marriage rights and civil marriage benefits and responsibilities and obligations. That is, I think, important to point out that religious marriage is another matter altogether. And I would never advocate that religious organizations be told what to do by the state. We're really talking about what those civil marriage rights are. In 1997, the General Accounting Office, at the direction of Representative Henry Hyde, conducted a survey which talked about how many benefits there are according to the federal laws that benefit heterosexual couples in marriage. They found at that time that there are 1,049 benefits. In January, they reviewed their materials and upped that number to 1,138. I have with me today copies of that GAO report if anybody would like to see them. But the important point here is to understand that there are civil benefits of marriage that accrue in the United States. If we pass this constitutional amendment, what we are doing is singling out one group of people over another to not receive those benefits. It is not fair. What we're saying is people who are tax-paying citizens, who own homes, who have children, who have families, are not able to have the same benefits by law and the same rights and responsibilities as other people. That is just unjust. It also allows government interference in some relationships. It allows the government to step in and say, we're going to tell these people they're okay and these people that they're not. And I think that's inherently wrong. There has been some discussion about heterosexual marriage being in a state of crisis or being in trouble. Now, whether I agree with that or not is really not the point here. But the point to make here about that is this. If heterosexual marriage is in trouble, if there are problems with heterosexual marriage in this country, the way to fix that problem is not to create a constitutional amendment that bans same-sex marriage. They don't have a relationship to each other. They're different things. We don't get married now. We don't contribute to the civil marriage group. In fact, conservative columnist David Brooks says, The conservative course is not to banish gay people from making such commitments. It is to expect that they will make such commitments. We shouldn't just allow gay marriage. We should insist on gay marriage. We should regard it as scandalous that two people could claim to love each other and not want to sanctify their love with marriage and fidelity. I think that's a pretty strong and important statement. Last thing I want to tell you, before I tell you a little story about this, is that same-sex couples are already engaged in strong, committed relationships. And we have been for a long time. There are people in this hearing room and people who are watching this who have been in relationships with their same partners for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Many of those couples have children. And many of those children came during the course of the relationship, not in a prior marriage. So we have some of the same concerns and legitimate issues that other couples have in this society. And I think they should be recognized. Yesterday, I was talking to a friend of mine who I've known for many years. And she told me that 2 years ago, she married her husband on the 18th anniversary of their first date. They have been together and lived together all of those years. They have a child together. She was not interested in getting married, in part because she thought that marriage was a discriminatory institution because people in same-sex relationships weren't able to get married. She was in a serious car accident, was almost killed, and just after that found out that she had breast cancer. She was very, very ill. And she went home and decided she had to get married because she had to stop putting her son and her relationship in jeopardy. There were too many things at stake not to legalize that relationship. And so regardless of the principle that she had about not marrying someone because of what other people couldn't do, she got married. And what I said to her was, I would never ask you or anyone else to jeopardize your family or your relationship or anything else for any reason. And what I'm here to say to you today, and I think you will hear this over and over again from the opponents of this bill, is we are asking you to not put our families and our relationships in harm's way. Don't jeopardize our families. We are as vulnerable to problems, accidents, difficulties as anyone else. And it is critical to this society that we are all able to be in stable relationships and that our government recognizes that equally across classes of people. Thank you. Now I'd like to introduce Professor Mary Jane Morrison. She's a professor of constitutional law at Hamline University, and she has also written a textbook on the Minnesota State Constitution.
The chair recognizes Professor Morrison. Professor Morrison, if you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Mary Jane Morrison. Thank you for inviting me to be here this afternoon. I am here to speak on a slightly more technical issue, and that is whether this bill, as it's drafted, does what the sponsors think it does, and whether that's wise or a disgrace. The bill, as it's drafted, appears to have two propositions in the first section, but to submit only one of them to the voters in the question to be submitted to the voters. That risks the possibility of having the proposal held to be multifarious and to have the amendment, if it's adopted by the electorate, invalidated on grounds that the submission violated the Constitution's Article 9, Section 1, the last sentence of which says that if two or more amendments are submitted at the same time, voters shall vote for or against each separately. If the second sentence of the first section adds no meaning to the bill, then there's not a problem of multifarious submission, and the question being submitted to the voters is just fine. But then the bill is only about defining the word marriage and putting it in the Constitution, which seems a little unwise since it just clutters the Constitution the way the Constitution's already cluttered with a clause saying who gets to keep the seal of the state. Or else it's about limiting future legislatures, not just the courts, but the future legislatures, the way that the provision on hunting and fishing limits future legislatures. If the second sentence is supposed to have distinct meaning, which seems reasonable in terms of the way it reads, then the distinct meaning seems to be disgraceful and unconstitutional. It seems to say that the benefits that are afforded married people cannot be afforded to any other group of people under any name whatsoever. And that seems to fly in the face of the decisions of various state courts about equal protection and in face of the Supreme Court of the United States decision in Romer versus Evans about equal protection under the federal Constitution. So if this is a simple question to be submitted to the voters, it's paradoxical that the submission question isn't simple and doesn't replicate the section's first two sentences, but only replicates one. And that leads to the problem about whether the bill could be held unconstitutional as an unconstitutional procedural matter without ever having to reach any other question under the Constitution. Thank you.
And also speaking is Robert Sikora. Robert is an attorney in Minneapolis.
The chair recognizes Mr. Sikora. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Sikora. Mr. Chair and members, I come before you today to suggest that it's a very bad idea to mess around with the Constitution on the issue that you have before you today. But first, let me back up a minute. We know each other. I work for you. I give you advice on far more dry matters than this. And I want to note that I'm taking vacation time to be with you here. But let me tell you something also about the nervous little culture of state agency representatives to which I belong. We come before you, powerful legislators, and we ask for money and we ask for decisions about policy. And I can tell you that it's common wisdom among us that it's a very foolish thing to do what I'm doing before you today, to take a stand on a controversial issue. And I tell you this because I want you to be aware of the depth of feeling that compels me to come and speak before you this afternoon. I come and speak before you this afternoon because I'm gay and because I can't remain silent when I hear people like Professor Collette suggest to you that I'm evil. That's why I'm here. I started out talking about fear, really, my fear about what you may do to me. But fear is actually kind of wrapped through my discussion with you this afternoon. We have a new kind of fear in our country, and it's been around since September 2001. And since the attacks on September 11th, we look to leaders like you to unite us. We want you to help us be stronger together, to pull together across our differences. We look for wisdom in our leaders. We look for focus. We look for the kind of integrity that is willing to say no to the politics of division, that is willing to say no to wedge issues, no to divide and conquer strategies. Now, you all remember that right after 9/11, the phrase,
United We Stand began to be visible. Can we really be united? Can we pull together across the differences that divide us? Are we really able to stand united? Or is this just a cheap bumper sticker slogan, no, just as thin as the paper it's printed on? By creating a constitutional fight over this issue, ladies and gentlemen, you are encouraging divisions. Division between mother and son, parent and child, brother and sister, between neighbors. You accentuate our differences instead of pulling us together as we rely upon you to do. You fail to help us stand united. Now, I've spoken to a few of you individually about the idea that we all should have the freedom to establish committed, stable, loving, legal relationships with another adult whom we love. It seems to me that only the most extreme people in our society are offended by this notion. In fact, the objections that I hear from you are very different. In my conversation, if I may, Representative Holberg, yesterday Representative Holberg told me, I just have strong feelings about traditional marriage. I can understand that. People with Representative Holberg's view, people who have this view of traditional marriage, also seem to be able to see the unfairnesses that are created when lesbian and gay couples are denied the same sort of legal protections that opposite-sex couples obtain by getting marriage. I know that many of you, like President Bush, support the idea of civil unions when you recognize these unfairnesses. I'd like you to think about civil unions for a minute. I think they can be used to resolve the issues before you in a way that pulls people together instead of driving them apart. The way to do it is to deal with both the marriage and civil union issues at the same time. Here's my suggestion. First of all, say no to the idea of messing around with the Constitution. These issues don't belong enshrined in the Constitution. You can instead create laws that respect the tradition of marriage by simply giving the concept back to the religions. Let the denominations decide for themselves what marriage is. This idea respects the rights of religion to carry on their businesses the way they see fit. It respects the division between church and state. It respects the free exercise clause. On the civil side, where you have an obligation to create and maintain a framework of laws that provide equal protection, on the civil side, you can make civil unions available to every adult, straight or gay, every adult who wishes to enter a committed, loving, legal relationship with another adult. Marriage, the institution administered by religions; civil unions, the institution recognized by the state. This set of solutions will pull us together as a society instead of encouraging more fighting about our differences. This solution does not play upon fear, and I'll even help you draft the language. Representative Holberg, you know where to find me. I'd be happy to talk with any of you about this issue, and I hope that you feel free to contact me to do so. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Groot, does that conclude your testimony?
Thank you very much, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Groot, Professor Morrison, and Mr. Sikora. We will now move into public testimony in favor of House File 2798. The chair will recognize Ms. Julie Light. Ms. Light, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Julie Light. Chairman, representatives, and guests, I am before you as a supporter of the proposed marriage amendment to Minnesota's Constitution. Given recent judicial decisions attempting to change the meaning of marriage, the only way to prevent further alteration of the social construct of marriage is to amend our Constitution to define what has been the case for thousands of years, and that is that marriage is the union of one man and one woman. Natural law dictates that marriage is the union of a pair of opposite-sex adults whose flesh unite in a reproductive manner, whether or not children result in this physical union. Simply because a family does not have such a relationship within it due to divorce, death, single parenthood, etc., does not nullify this definition. It only means that a given family does not have within it a married couple. Those in favor of same-sex marriages argue that some people are denied certain rights that other people are granted, that some people are discriminated against. This is just not so. Under our Minnesota Constitution, heterosexuals, homosexuals, have every single right that every other person does, all the same, including all laws and rules and benefits surrounding marriage. Homosexuals have the right to marry exactly who every single adult is entitled to marry, and that is a single adult person of the opposite sex. You may also hear from same-sex marriage proponents that heterosexuals can marry who they want to marry, but that homosexuals cannot. The language here must be looked at carefully. First, it is based on wants, not rights. I may want to live in a multimillion-dollar mansion belonging to someone else, but that doesn't mean I have the right to do so. I may want to trade jobs with even someone who would like to do the same with me, and yet that doesn't mean I have the right to do so. Further, there are many heterosexual adults who can't marry who they want to marry. If I wanted to marry my brother, I could not. In fact, if I wanted to marry another adult male, I could not, because I am already married. I ask you to be visionaries and realize the implications of not supporting marriage in the way it has always been recognized. I ask you to realize that there is not one argument that same-sex marriage proponents use today or could use tomorrow that could not then be used for having marriage legally recognized as the legal union of anybody, anything, or any group. If marriage no longer requires a man and a woman, and if marriage is merely based on loving, committed relationships, then there would be no reason not to allow parents to marry their children, grandparents to marry their grandchildren, or people to marry their pets. These relationships are all forms of love and commitment. They all involve commitment and care, and even families. The reality, though, is none of them are marriage. And of course, do children no longer need a mother and a father? If we redefine marriage to allow same-sex marriage, the question then is, who's dispensable, the father or the mother? The fact is, both are vitally important, not only for bringing children into this world, but raising them into healthy, the future of America. You as legislators have a very important decision before you. Reaffirming the fundamental institution of society or redefining it out of existence. May each of you feel the weight of our future on your shoulders. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Light. The chair will now recognize Mr. Brian Walker and make 2 points. First of all, House Civil Law Committee rules forbid the use of cell phones in the hearing room. I've heard a couple already. If you have a cell phone with you today, turn it off. My second point is I'd like to remind everybody once again we're on a block of time, so please be mindful if you're providing testimony today of those who are behind you. Mr. Walker, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Brian Walker, a resident of Brooklyn Center, currently unemployed. My wife and I head up a ministry to post the Board of Couples and also volunteers marriage class leaders for a nonprofit located in the north side of Minneapolis that ministers to the families of men and women currently incarcerated and or on drug treatment. I have a statement here and then have a few closing remarks. In the days of slavery, a black child was more likely to grow up with living with both parents than he or she is today. The African-American family is already under great stress, with 80% of our families being headed by the mother. Studies have already shown that a child benefits most with a mother and father present in the household. As a Christian and an African American, I am alarmed that any redefinition of marriage should be even entertained. This union has served as a cornerstone for societies for thousands of years. The potential for the court to rewrite this definition can further devastate the black family. I argue that same-sex marriage, that same-sex marriage is not a civil right, but rather a sexual, cultural, and political preference attempting to wrap itself in the rhetoric and tactics in memory of those who endured the police dog and the water cannons of the 50s and 60s. I ask this committee in good conscience to weigh the cost in assuring not just this present electorate, but generations to come that redefining marriage will not be left up to the courts, but rather as defended as a union of one man and one woman. To bring such a fundamental change in the definition of marriage, this committee has a duty and responsibility to prove a compelling reason why this definition should not be changed. The health and human services provided and regulated by the state of Minnesota are at stake. And I just want to close with just speaking that there is an equal fear of folks that want to have marriage defended as the right between a man and a woman. There's a fear that what we heard described in the testimony of earlier about, for want of a better word, PC, or the current trend, people having to sign up and enlist on basically checking off as agreement that this is, that they agreeing that same-sex marriage is okay. What happens to those who sincerely believe in their heart, whether they are religious or not, believe that this definition should not be changed? It's really on the weight of the committee and also our legislatures to make sure that the people of Minnesota have a right to weigh in on this. This cannot be left up to the whims of court justices or the small committees. And if we are truly are to pull together on this issue, then it should be one that should be left to the voters and for the voters to decide. And that's my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. The chair will now recognize Father Thomas Duffner. Good afternoon, Father. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Father Thomas Duffner, Holy Family Catholic Church, St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we stand here at the brink of an enormous decision, the question about the revision of the Constitution of the United States. Current attempts to redefine marriage fly in the face of thousands of years of Judeo-Christian experience. A theology of the body growing out of sacred scripture would indicate a context for us that our bodies, far from being possessions, still us machines, are made in the image of God. Bodies capable of making visible what is invisible, the spiritual, the divine, the mystery of a hidden God. And there's signs of it. The physical body and the creatures, that we cannot see God. He's pure spirit. But God wanted to make this mystery of his Godhead visible to us, and he stamped the sign on us, making us in his own image. We're meant to act as God acts. Not only individually, but communally, we form communities, images of the Trinity, we would say. And that the love between husband and wife would bring forth new life. All of this, we believe, is a sacred sign, something very precious, something very powerful. Well, what does it all mean? It means that in our bodies, there's a nuptial meaning imprinted upon us. The psychological, the physical complementarity of man and woman are called to become a gift for one another, a gift fully realized in the one flesh union. Secondly, there's a generative meaning, that God willing, they bring forth a third person, a new child, that this primordial sacrament, this image of the mystery of God's Trinitarian life, all of this is meant to be shown to the world in and through marriage of husband and wife. Now, of course, the temptation is not just to want to be images of God, but to want to be God, to not be content with being mere images, not to discover right and wrong, but to determine right and wrong. And so we find that love is quickly corrupted to lust. And as soon as a sexual union is divorced from its inherent link with procreation, any means to sexual fulfillment becomes justified. We've grown accustomed to this idea in our own generation. But now to the point of this hearing, should homosexual unions be accorded the rights and privileges of marriage? Marriage really is enshrined in law, supported with various civil, financial benefits, because the good of the state is at stake. Nations and states have a vested interest in promoting stable marriage. It's the source of new citizens with stable character, upright morals, who share the values of the nation. Nations should be doing everything possible to discourage easy divorce. The data is in. We see the effects upon the children. Marriage is not about claiming some sort of an individual right. It's an institution. It's about safeguarding certain basic interests the society has in stability of the family as an institution, the proper care of children, and enforcing the mutual obligations of parenting between husband and wife and toward the children. Now, the homosexual unions, none of these are present. Homosexual acts share none of the psychological complementarity of the sexes. Homosexual acts share none of the physical complementarity, and the acts are inherently sterile. The homosexual acts are not truthful signs of God's love in the world. From time immemorial, homosexual acts have been considered immoral. And the absence of sexual complementarity in these unions creates an obstacle in the normal development of children who might be placed under such circumstances. And so I ask you, as a committed member of Christianity and a member of this polity here, that we might oppose this type of a change. I stand for the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Father. The chair will recognize Rabbi Daniel Borenstein. Good afternoon, Rabbi. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. It's Joshua, Rabbi Joshua Borenstein.
Josh,
and
my apologies.
And it's the I represent the Torah Academy in St. Louis Park, and also I'm bringing a similar message from the Rabbi of Congregation Beis Yisrael, which is the largest Orthodox Jewish congregation in the state. I just wanted to make a few points regarding this amendment and the ramifications of the potential damage to the community if the marriage definition changes. Firstly, on an obvious religious standpoint and the religious laws that we teach our children, it would be a big blow to us and our school system and everywhere else in what we can teach the children if the state is sanctifying one thing and the school system in our homes, we are teaching them something else. It is a contradiction that will be very hard for us to get over. Financially, to the state, it is an enormous can of worms that I don't think anybody has thought through all the way what will happen if we open up this can. And all the way running from if, like somebody said before, a father wants to marry a son, well, that's a good way to transfer $100 million and not pay any estate taxes. All sorts of things like that that haven't been thought through, all the scenarios that will come out if we change the definition of marriage to just be two people. But lastly, I want to speak about what it is that we want to have in Minnesota. I hear people saying that the state shouldn't be involved in marriage at all. It's a religious issue, and it's not a state issue at all. That's fine if all the state wants to do is have a law-abiding state with people that keep the laws, and they don't commit murder, and they don't steal, and they don't do anything that's wrong. But for those of us that have a mission for the people of the state of Minnesota, a little beyond that, and that would like to see the people that grow up and are raised in the state of Minnesota to not just be law-abiding citizens, but to actually be good people, moral people that do good things, those are things that cannot be taught by the government, by law enforcement, by any way but the home. Only in the home will people learn how to give charity. Only at home will they learn how to be good people, act nicely, be it visiting the sick, holding the door open for an elderly person. Whatever the subject matter may be, there are no laws we can legislate to make people become good people. Minnesota Nice came from somewhere, and primarily that comes from an education that you get at home from your family. And so many of us, including studies, believe that the ideal family situation is a father and a mother. And if the state, in fact, wants to see us get to a point where we have good people and moral people, then we need to best facilitate that opportunity and encourage that opportunity in the ideal situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi. The chair recognizes Dave Burkett. Good afternoon, Mr. Burkett. If you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and the public. My name is Dave Burkett. I'm a business owner. I'm a father of three, and this year my wife and I are reaching the 25-year mark in our marriage. I want to thank you for the privilege to come before you today, and I believe that a majority of Minnesotans would hold my view that you, as our representatives, must do whatever you can to defend the definition of marriage as one man and one woman. I believe that history has something to teach us if we'll listen. But my own personal experience has taught me the important role that a father and a mother have in the life of their children. That the experiments in de facto gay marriage in Scandinavia are demonstrating that this is not a path that our state should follow. First, the lessons of history are provided to instruct us. The strength of our social fabric as a nation has been marriage. The French visitor Alexis de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America in the 1830s, and he found a nation that was tolerant in many areas, but severe in its defense of marriage. He wrote, "All those vices which tend to impair the purity of morals and stability in marriage are treated in America with a severity unknown in the rest of the world. At first sight, this seems in strange contrast to their toleration in other matters. One is surprised to find in one and the same nation a morality both so relaxed and so austere. Secondly, my personal experience has shown me that children are better served with a mother and a father. Year after we were married, I began my experience of parenting. 22 years later, I can tell you that mothers and fathers parent differently, mothers and fathers play differently, fathers push limits, mothers encourage security, mothers and fathers communicate differently, mothers and fathers discipline differently, mothers and fathers prepare children for life differently. Both mothers and fathers are important in the lives of children. And finally, it is being widely reported that traditional marriage as an institution in Scandinavia is, quote, in a state of collapse. Stanley Kurtz, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, who's recently published article, The End of Marriage in Scandinavia, states that marriage in Scandinavia is in deep decline, with children shouldering the burden of rising rates of family disillusion, and the mainspring of the decline, an increasingly sharp separation between marriage and parenthood, can be linked to gay marriage. In expanding on his comment regarding gay marriage, he writes, Scandinavian gay marriage has driven home the message that marriage itself is outdated. He goes on to say, by the time we see the effects of gay marriage in America, it will be too late to do anything about it. Yet we needn't wait that long. In effect, Scandinavia has run our experiment for us. The results are in. I have the full article and will leave it for your review. In conclusion, all citizens, including policymakers, should do their part to uphold the institution of marriage because it provides the best environment for raising children who are the future of our society. Strengthening marriage creates a stronger foundation for the family, the basic social building block, and produces a stronger state that benefits many future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burkett. The chair now recognizes Hamsi El Sawaf. Mr. El Sawaf, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and I'm thankful and grateful to all of you for inviting me today. My name is Hamdi El Sawaf, the Executive Director of the Islamic Center in Minnesota, and also the Imam of Columbia Heights Mosque at Columbia Heights. In the name of Allah, most gracious and most merciful, I greet all of you with the greeting of Islam, peace, mercy, and blessings of God upon all of you. Marriage in Islam is an agreement, commitment, and a covenant between a man and woman. In general, the purpose of marriage is that both men and women can provide company to one another, love to one another, procreate children, and live in peace and tranquility the commandments of God. Marriage in Islam serves as a means to emotional and sexual gratification and as means of tension reduction. Marriage is seen as the only way possible for the sexes to unite. It is also a form of worship because it is displaying obedience to God, our Creator, and also to His Messenger. The cycle of life continues with the marriage between men and women, which is the natural way that the Creator has created us for. In accordance to Islam, marriage is a religious duty and is consequently a moral safeguard as well as a social necessity. It is a social necessity because through marriage, families are established and the family is the fundamental unit of our society. Furthermore, marriage is the only legitimate way to indulge in intimacy between a man and a woman. This is not only part of our belief in Islam, but also beyond that, it is the belief of all humanity. To this end, Muslims in Minnesota support HF 2798 as introduced. Thank you. May God's peace, mercy, and blessing be with all of you.
Thank you. Chair will now recognize Mr. Dave Rasmussen. Good afternoon, Mr. Rasmussen. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dave Rasmussen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives, for allowing me to share this afternoon. I am co-director of Fathom Ministries, a local Christian ministry that devotes our time to helping those people who want to overcome homosexuality. I've been married for 33 years, and for the majority of that time, I struggled with homosexuality myself. My wife and I entered marriage thinking it would be a cure. Marriage is not a cure, but God can be. He intervened in my life at a point in my marriage when I cried out for help in the most desperate time. I had thought change was impossible. He, however, began to open doors for me that gave me hope for change. At the age of 20, had I lived in a culture like today's that is beginning to sanction same-sex marriage, I probably would not have married my wife and would have pursued the gay life. I was very promiscuous and probably would have died of AIDS. 30 years ago, there was a strict moral boundary in our culture that I strived to live by. When people sanction same-sex marriages, what you're telling our young people is that there is no hope for change if you want to be free from homosexuality. I'm not going to tell you that change for me was easy. It was not. I'm not going to tell you that change happened overnight. It did not. It was a long process. But change, thank God, did happen. And I can honestly say that I have never been happier in my marriage, and I have never been happier personally than I am today. I was honored 3 years ago to be a part of a study done by Dr. Robert Spitzer of Columbia University, who in 1973 led the way to have homosexuality be removed from the list of psychiatric disorders. In his most recent study 3 years ago, however, Dr. Spitzer, who by the way is not a Christian, found after interviewing several hundred men and women who had a strong commitment to leave homosexuality and coupled with a strong faith in God, did indeed change their sexual orientation. His newfound conclusion was, change is possible for those who want to. And there are many more, many, many more. Hundreds of men and women who are part of a network of ministries called Exodus International, who are standing up to be counted and declaring that freedom from homosexuality is possible when they make Jesus Lord of their life.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. The chair will now recognize Gerard Dawes. Good afternoon, Mr. Dulles. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. I do have a copy for the committee. Thank you very much. Hello, my name is Gerard Doles, and I'm here today to talk to you about the reasons in which I am for the amendment. You might be wondering why my opinion matters, and the reason is that I came out of the homosexual lifestyle, and I no longer live that way. I just celebrated my 25th anniversary. It has not been an easy road, however, it has been the best road I could ever take. I hope that the militant homosexuals can accept my leaving the homosexual lifestyle. Before I begin talking to you about my opinion, I'd like to make a point and talk to you about what marriage means and why it should be kept between a man and a woman. Those reasons are: marriage between a man and a woman is God's design for reproducing and perfecting the human race. It is still the ideal situation of nurturing young lives through emotional health and well-being. The process of reproducing and cultivating the human race makes the marriage of a man to a woman the most important relationship in the civilization. It must be honored, protected, and held above any other relationship or union of people. When children are brought up to maturity through the loving relationship between a man and a woman, they receive the best possible foundation for a successful future relationship with all both sexes. Let's be really, really honest here. I believe that the radical homosexuals have a major agenda, that if they could pass a law to allow gay marriage in not only this state, but in all the states, that they will also start coming against our schools, our churches, and our Christian values. I would like also to say that not all homosexuals are radical homosexuals. Just like in 9/11, it was not all Muslims, just the radical Muslims that did the attacks. If they could pass this law, when will they ask? Will they ask for 2, 3, or even 4 people to be married at one time? Will they want to let teenage boys and girls then marry? If the law of gay marriage is passed, where is it going to end? What is going to be in line? When will we know when we have gone too far? For example, approximately 6 months ago in Canada, it was stated in their new law that if someone stated anything of coming out of homosexuality in a church, you could lose your license, your church, or even go to prison. That is a scary, scary thing, that if they pass the law to allow gay marriage, that the same thing that happened in Canada will happen to our Christian values in America. I will say this, I am not ashamed to be called a Christian, just like they are not ashamed to be called a militant homosexual radical group called ACT UP. I would like to respond to lawmakers here. Let's not destroy the fabric of marriage by a few radical homosexuals. Once we go too far, there's no going back. Once these militant homosexuals get their way, they will keep wanting more. You might think that I'm being harsh against homosexual community, but after I have lived that lifestyle and have suffered great pains, I want people to know that there's freedom out there. The greatest weapon that I can use against homosexuality or homosexuals is my love for them and to see them free. I do believe that gay people have every human rights on this earth, but I don't think they have a right to discriminate against marriage between a man and a woman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We've got about 2 minutes left here, and the chair will recognize Mr. Glenn Grunhagen.
That's traveling time, count against the 2 minutes.
I don't believe we pay windshield time, Mr. Grunhagen. If you'd care to state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Glenn Grunhagen. And I'm a public school board member for about 8 years. I also have a copy of my testimony for the committee members. You'd like to hand it out. Just a brief background also. Prior to being on the school board, public school board, I spent about 13 years in jail ministry. So I took a lot of voluntary time to help people who are hurting or made bad decisions in their lives. I am for the passage of a constitutional amendment to divine marriage as between one man and one woman, thereby prohibiting homosexual marriage, civil unions, or other potential marriages. Please give Minnesota citizens the opportunity this November to decide this critical issue, rather than unelected judges as in Massachusetts. Activist liberal judges who violate the Constitution and make law should be impeached. If gay activists want to legalize civil unions, then let them do it through the legislative process, and not by judicial fiat. Now I'd like to address one of my primary concerns as a public school board member. The redefinition of marriage will directly impact the education of our children in the schools. Social studies and health curriculum will invariably teach the acceptance of homosexuality as normal. Positive lifestyles, since it is the law of the state. How ironic that the 1993 gay rights legislation, when passed, contained a prohibition on the promotion of homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle in the public schools. But with the redefinition of marriage, the teaching of homosexuality should be expected. I have given you a packet with examples made available to public schools shortly after that 1993 law was passed, which in effect promote homosexuality and their sexual behaviors to public school students. It appears this material is in violation of state statute. Today in our public schools, we have the Mankato Capstone Press publishing books for elementary children that seems to encourage students in dangerous and unhealthy sexual behaviors. Out for Equity, a program in the St. Paul Public Schools, and the Amaze Book Project has over 30 books and videos that teach acceptance of homosexuality for elementary grade school children, and 22 books and videos for junior and senior high students. Promotion of books such as Heather Has Two Mommies and other pro-homosexual materials will be forced on all young school children as a result of the redefinition of marriage. My point is that legalizing gay marriage will give the ultimate stamp of approval on homosexual behavior and will lead to more of this type of material taught to our children in the public schools. This also violates many of the religious convictions of students and causes confusions. Also included in your packet are two examples of what is censored out of the public school curriculum, mainly individuals who have left the homosexual lifestyle, such as was previously testified by personal stories. Please, if you care about the health and the welfare of the children, and I know you do, okay, and individuals trapped in this unhealthy and deadly lifestyle, vote to give Minnesotans an opportunity to amend our state constitution and protect the institution of marriage. Sodomy is wrong whether practiced between heterosexuals or homosexuals. It spreads sickness, disease, pain, suffering, and death. We should enforce our public health laws to help people stop that behavior rather than looking for ways to legally condone it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gruenhagen. We will now move to 30 minutes of public testimony in opposition to House File 2798. The chair will note for the record that that block of testimony ran at about 32 minutes, and so if necessary, the chair will afford the same amount of time to those testifying in opposition. Chair will recognize Mr. Mike Fry. Good afternoon, Mr. Fry. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Fry, and I have to confess to the committee that I have been, in part, a little reluctant to testify today because my experience has been that people, when discussing this issue, have largely made up their mind based on past experience and are not necessarily real flexible to moving or changing their position on this issue one way or the other. I'm hoping that that's not the case with the committee members here today. I'd also like to say that that I would like the public record to show that my family and I stood up for equal rights and equal protection, because I think that this is a historic moment in our country, and I'm privileged to be able to have the record show that. Our founding fathers actually predicted this day would come, but before I get into talking about that, I'd like to share just a little bit of my personal story for you, because I think it's important that you understand how this legislation will directly affect people like me. I've been in a monogamous relationship for about 20 years with a man whom I love dearly. Our lives are typical, like you would see in any household. Two jobs, two cars, three pets. We share everything, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially. We are one unit. You cannot do anything financially to either of us without affecting both of us. We're a single economic unit in society. Whether or not our relationship is sin or sacrament is not something for this committee to discuss or question. That's something to be left between George and I and our God. It's not up to you. On Valentine's Day weekend, an ordained minister, in a ceremony that was joyous, affirming, and loving, married us in the San Francisco Rotunda, City Hall Rotunda. It was a moment that I will never forget for the rest of my life. And I would like to thank the officials there who volunteered their time to bring that joy and celebration to the couples who were there celebrating that. But that wasn't the first time that I committed my life to my partner, George. In 2000, George, his father's a lay minister, performed a service for us in Sugar Bush Lodge in Warren, Vermont, with 20 of our closest friends and family who wept with joy. But the first time we committed our love together was actually in 1985, after we purchased our first home together. Just the two of us in front of our fireplace, we exchanged rings, we held each other, and we cried. In addition to our marriage licenses and civil union licenses, we've drafted a stack of legal documents that include legal powers of attorney for making medical decisions for each other. We have written wills, living wills, and stacks of other legal documents in an attempt to try to carve out basic protections that are automatically afforded heterosexual couples. Unfortunately, we can only get a small sliver of those, and because the state treats George and I as, in effect, total strangers, those documents are open to legal challenges. And if you check the court records in recent history, you'll find that those documents are oftentimes challenged by blood relatives of same-sex couples, and they're thrown out of court. So in spite of our work, it could be nothing, and we could, in effect, have no protection. I'm still unable to get something so basic as dental coverage because the small nonprofit organization that I work for doesn't offer dental coverage, and George works for government, and his employer is prevented by law from giving coverage to me. So I have no dental coverage. Every paycheck, the government takes $150 out of George's paycheck to go into a pension fund that he's required to contribute to and which I can't access if anything happens to him. Think about that. The government is taking money from me out of every paycheck, and I have no control or say or access to that. People who put forth this amendment would like to believe that, you know, recognizing our relationship, something that actually exists, is going to somehow undermine heterosexual relationships. And they'll talk about European countries like the Netherlands and Denmark, where marriage rates are arguably quite low. But if you look at the data, the marriage rates in those countries, before gay marriage and after, you're going to find that, in fact, there's been no change. The Netherlands was the first country who passed gay marriage, and that was 3 years ago, and nothing has changed. Their marriage institution has not fallen apart. And common sense actually will just tell you that if you offer George and I recognition of the relationship that clearly exists, that's not going to have an effect on any existing heterosexual relationships. Earlier I said that our founding fathers predicted today would come. And what I meant by that was not that they predicted the gay marriage debate, but they did predict that our nation would eventually degrade into a tyranny. They said in many writings on that subject that because of human nature, all societies eventually degrade into a tyranny, where the beliefs and opinions of the majority override the rights and the beliefs of the minority. Understanding that they couldn't prevent that from happening, they drafted the U.S. Constitution and established the state's constitutional system in hopes of slowing down that process. According to them, the speed at which that deterioration would happen depended in large part on the amount of esteem in which we held the Constitution. They predicted the day would come, though, that when people would begin changing the Constitution to suit their own personal beliefs and agendas. Ben Franklin made a famous speech in 1789 about the Constitution, in which he prophesied that the American democracy would ultimately fail because despotic men would slowly enfeeble the Constitution as they mutate America into a tyranny. The Constitution was created specifically to benefit and protect minorities. Using it as a means to restrict the rights of an unpopular minority is not only a misuse of that document, it is the beginning of the fulfillment of the predictions made by our founding forefathers. I believe that the members of the Civil Law Committee should reflect long and hard on the writings of those wise men who founded this country before considering amending the Constitution in this way and taking a giant step toward creating the tyranny they predicted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frey. The chair will now recognize Mr. Dan Gita. Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee. My name is Dan Gita. I'm the Acting Executive Director of the League of Minnesota Human Rights Commissions and a member of Red Wing PFLAG, Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Amending the Minnesota Constitution to define marriage as the union only between a man and a woman would be a historic step backwards in guaranteeing equal rights for all and enshrines discrimination into our Constitution. Much of my career as a civics teacher and counselor in the Red Wing School District was spent teaching about the history of the expansion of human rights in this country. As a civics teacher, I taught my students about their rights as citizens, the Declaration of Independence states, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all people, are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That historic Declaration of Rights in 1776 is the touchstone for human rights in this country. And yet when it was written, it was not interpreted to include equal rights for women, for slaves, for Indians, nothing to say about GLBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons of that day. The Constitution and Bill of Rights were ratified in 1791. Moves to expand those guaranteed rights were often met with anguished pleas to maintain the status quo and warnings of the impending threat to the very future of our country. The march of history brought demands for change, resulting in amendments abolishing slavery in 1865, prohibiting the denying of rights based on race in 1870, giving women the right to vote in 1920, guaranteeing the right to vote in 1964, and allowing 18-year-olds the right to vote in 1971 and others. Each of these amendments broadened and protected the rights of U.S. citizens. The Minnesota Constitution, ratified in 1857, states, no member of this state shall be disfranchised or deprived of any of the rights secured to any citizen thereof. And yet, here we are today debating an amendment to our state constitution, not to protect the rights of citizens, but to deny rights and privileges of marriage to GLBT persons. This amendment will deprive GLBT citizens rights and privileges, which I believe are and should be guaranteed in the Minnesota and United States Constitution. My awareness of civil rights began in high school in the early 1960s. The civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, rights for women, the right of 18-year-olds to vote, allowing couples of mixed races to marry, all impacted my beliefs on equal rights for all. However, it is as the parent of a gay son that I learned at the personal level the importance of those rights and of the ignorance, injustice, and bigotry directed toward GLBT persons, including my son. I need to say to you most emphatically that our son did not choose to be gay, just as our daughter did not choose to be straight. Our family is in the midst of planning for our daughter's wedding. Sandy and I are so pleased that she has found someone to share her love and life. It is the hope we all have for our children that they will be happy. I was talking with our son last week about his sister's wedding. He looked at me and said, "You'll need to plan for a wedding for me too, you know." I was complaining about the finances of it. It was great to know that our son looks forward to the time when he and his soulmate will have a legal marriage and all of the rights that entails. But it also made me even more angry and saddened that amendments to our Minnesota and United States Constitution are being introduced to take that right to happiness away from him. It has been said that this amendment is about protecting marriage. I do not understand how my daughter's marriage is protected by not allowing my son that same right. In fact, our family would be strengthened by the commitment of both of our children in marriage. I mentioned that prior to retirement, I was a counselor at Red Wing High School. Over the years, I worked with many GLBT students as they struggled to come to terms with their sexuality. Gay students are the most harassed group in our schools today. Consequently, often these students live in fear. 2 years ago, a ninth grade student made an appointment to see me. Eventually, he told me he was gay. But he was afraid, of what would happen at home if his father found out. He was fearful of his father's response and was sure he'd be kicked out of the family. Last week, I was asked to take some time and come back to school to talk with him again. Things have not been going well for him in school. His attendance and grades are poor. And we met and we talked about what was going on. He told me that he had come out as gay to his family. His father did not kick him out of the house as expected, at least not yet. However, he said his dad looked at him and in disgust called him a faggot. The impact of this amendment is much more far-reaching than that of allowing GLBT persons marriage rights. Passing this amendment sends a very clear message that one group of our citizens are less than equal. Gay youth in every school in our state are listening to this debate. They are watching and listening for leaders of this state and of this nation to say, "You are not faggots and dykes. You are just as valued and have as much right to and chance for happiness and love in your life as your straight classmates, brothers, and sisters." I challenge each of you to vote to protect rights, not deny them. Please vote against the definition of marriage amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Guida. The chair will now recognize Dr. David Fredrickson. Dr. Fredrickson, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
David Fredrickson, Professor of New Testament at Luther Seminary. Thank you for hearing me. I speak against the proposed amendment because it would harm marriage and the process of public moral deliberation. First, the harm to marriage. Marriage is not what it used to be. I want to bring out the implications in what we have achieved culturally in our thinking about marriage in the last 50 years. If we were to limit our hopes for marriage to the kind of relationship that the Christian tradition has until recently imagined possible, then we would think of marriage as either a strategy for the restraint of our sexual passions or as a sacrament representing the hierarchical relationship between God and world, in which the activity of the masculine principle is harmonized with the passivity of the feminine principle. I will say this again less politely. Keep in mind that Christianity is my tradition, and I love it, and because I love it, I criticize it. Here it is again with less polish. Until the last decades, the best opinion Christian moral theology could offer the secular state was this. Marriage was either a release mechanism for sexual pressure for those who could not otherwise control themselves, or marriage was the institutionalization of gender stereotypes and gender inequality. Married people, however, have discovered something that the church did not know. The state needs to start paying attention to what married people know. Knowing what I know about marriage, having been married for 26 years, knowing at its most profound level, marriage is about shared lives. It's about friendship. It's about inexpressible tenderness and vulnerability and trust. Knowing these things, the amendment harms my spirit. The amendment forces me to go into the closet with my ridiculed mutuality and friendship and my fantasy of a shared life with my wife. Because the state, the guardian of public discourse, in deference to antiquated understandings of marriage, will have determined that marriages defined in my way are out of order. This brings me to the second consequence of the amendment. This amendment would signal the state's failure to promote democracy. Haven't I gotten this backwards? By putting the amendment to the people up for an up or down vote, isn't the state doing its duty to democracy? I would say so only if democracy is confined to the ballot box. But what if there is another dimension of democratic power that requires time for people to think out loud to test their truth claims in the company of others, and requires respect for the moral wisdom of the next generation of citizens? We have a duty to deliberative democracy. Gay marriage has polarized some of our citizens, but not all. There is a questioning middle out there. These are people with uncertainties they want to track down and conversations that they want to have. If the demand for a simple yes or no hits them right now, and a yes or no they know will be very difficult to revise, then they will have lost their freedom to engage in deliberative speech. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fredrickson. The chair will now recognize Ann Phibbs. Good afternoon, Ms. Phibbs. If you would identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Ann Phibbs, the GLBT Student Services Director at Metropolitan State University. Chairman De La Forest and representatives, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to my remarks today. I believe that the proposed constitutional amendment to define marriage as a union between one man and one woman is both unnecessary and discriminatory. It is unnecessary because this state has already passed the Defense of Marriage Act. It is discriminatory because it builds into our state's legal foundation the notion that benefits accrue to certain individuals based solely on the gender of their partner. Maybe if I give you a little of my own personal history, you can understand why this issue affects me so deeply. I was fortunate enough to be raised in a family that accepted me as a lesbian when I came out to them at the age of 18. My parents, two brothers and two sisters, all welcomed my partner, Deb, to this family 20 years ago. They also welcomed our two children, Dylan and Ada, when they arrived 12 and 9 years ago. Unfortunately, by the time I was 40 years old, I had lost both my parents, and my older sister, with whom I was very close, was dying of colon cancer at the age of 48. This sister, Laura, specifically asked that my twin sister, Catherine, and I be the ones to help her die at home. After battling cancer for 4 years, Catherine and I moved in with Laura for the last 3 months of her life, helping her 15-year-old son and her husband make the transition to living without her. You can imagine how close I am with my twin sister, Catherine. So much of our lives have been shaped by the same family dynamics, the same sacrifices, the same grief, and thank goodness the same joys of finding a life partner to love, of watching our children grow up, of enjoying our careers, our friends, and our communities. Catherine and her husband, Nils, have two wonderful sons who are very close to their cousins, my children. After Laura died, I was able to convince Catherine and Nils to relocate from Massachusetts to Minnesota. And now we live minutes away from each other, able to enjoy the parks and neighborhoods of the Twin Cities. So there's much that I share with my twin sister. But now let me tell you what I do not share with her, for the simple reason that she fell in love with a man and I with a woman. Despite the fact that Dev and I moved to Minnesota 15 years ago so that I could attend graduate school, and that we ended up staying here to raise our children, despite the fact that we own a home, we've paid taxes for 15 years, we are active in our church, our children's school, and our neighborhood, despite all that, my 20-year relationship has none of the privileges afforded to my sister's marriage. I can legally be denied access to my partner should she be hurt and taken to a hospital. I can legally be denied access to her body upon her death. I cannot count her as family under the Family Medical Leave Act. I cannot receive her Social Security benefits, even though we have shared our finances since I was 20 years old. I won't continue here as there are over 1,000 tangible benefits that apply to those couples who can legally recognize their relationships. I will say that as an employee of the state of Minnesota for the past 9 years, I was not able to cover my partner of 20 years under my health insurance after she was recently laid off from her job. My sister, who moved here 6 months ago, would have been able to cover her husband were she a state employee, but not me. I am here today to ask you to consider the unjustifiable inequity of my situation. I would ask all of you, honestly, if my sister, who, by the way, is completely against this constitutional amendment, to ask you if she is a more deserving person than I, simply because her partner is male and mine is female. Does she embody family values in a way that I do not? We both cared equally for my terminally ill sister. We both love and nurture our children. We both pay our taxes and obey the law. We both care deeply about the citizens of Minnesota and are active participants in the democratic process and the lives of our neighborhoods and communities. In July 2000, Deb and I participated in a civil union ceremony in Burlington, Vermont, at the urging of Deb's brother who lives there. I honestly didn't think it would mean very much to me because I live in the state of Minnesota and I knew that the benefits would only apply if I lived in Vermont. But I was wrong. I remember to this day how I felt when the clerk at the town office asked me for the names of my parents to put on the civil union form. I felt official, recognized. I felt like my relationship mattered, not more than my parents' relationship or my sister's relationship, nearly as much as theirs. I'm sad to say, as a gay person in this country, it was a strange feeling to feel equal. People in same-sex relationships are not asking for more rights or special rights. We want to be treated equally, nothing more. If I love my sister so much, why would I want more rights than her? And likewise, why would she want more than me? I am surrounded in my family, at work, in my neighborhood and church, with many, many heterosexual Minnesotans who do not need a constitutional amendment to feel secure in their relationships. They know that to divide Minnesotans into those whose relationships are legitimate and those whose relationships are not tears us apart as a community and as a state. I urge you to reject this constitutional amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Phibbs. The chair will now recognize Reverend Don Portwood.
Good
afternoon, Reverend. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Don Portwood. I am co-pastor at Lindale United Church of Christ in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I've served for the past 23 years. I've been married for over 30 years and have two children, two boys, 24 and 26. I come before you not only to oppose this proposed constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriage, but I write that same-sex marriage be legalized. Years ago, I was opposed to gay people having any rights. I believe that homosexuality was unnatural and was something people chose. In the course of my 28 years of ministry, both in a rural town in Wisconsin and now in Minneapolis, I've come to meet many people who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered. As I have talked with them and ministered with them, hearing their stories, I have discovered over and over again that very few people choose their sexual orientation. I've heard no one say, "Gosh, that gay lifestyle sounds exciting and fun. I think I'll give it a try." I've talked to men and women who, when they first discovered they were attracted to someone of the opposite sex, felt shame, horror, denial, and guilt. Many of those men and women did everything they could on their own not to be gay and turned in the Christian church to the healing power of Jesus Christ to help them overcome their homosexuality. I've known people raised in churches who preached of the horrors of homosexuality, who went to prayer services and healing services. My cousin went through the Exodus program that was mentioned earlier, that is supposed to heal gay people. None of the people I know were pleased, excited, or looking forward to living as a gay person. But at some point, by the grace of God, I think by the grace of God, they finally accepted who God had created them to be and decided to live out their lives as fully and as faithfully to God as they could. So much of the opposition to people who are gay comes from the religious institutions. I am not a homosexual activist. This is the first time I've ever spoken publicly about this. But I think it's important that you know that not all religious institutions are in favor of this amendment. I'm here this afternoon to remind you that there are many other Christians who love God, have a relationship with Jesus Christ, and believe the Holy Spirit is moving among us today. I am aware of what the Bible says about homosexuality. I have come to believe that it was not God who was opposed to homosexuality, but the understanding of the writers of the Bible. They said for someone to leave their nature was a sin. If as a heterosexual I had a homosexual experience, I would be going against my nature as a heterosexual person. But if I am gay and attracted to another man, then I am not going against my nature. The Bible tells us how the Hebrew and Christian community saw things, not, I believe, how God saw things. I do not believe the Bible literally, word for word. Nor do I believe you do, if you are followers of Hebrew or Christian scriptures. Otherwise, there are any number of laws and constitutional amendments you could be trying to pass about God's view on bigamy or polygamy, the marriage of non-virgins, and the abolition of divorce. I hear people talking about the sanctity of marriage as if allowing gay marriage will destroy the institution of marriage. On the contrary, allowing same-sex couples to marry only strengthens marriages, families, societies, and provides the same rights that I have as a married heterosexual. I've also heard people question how marriage could then be defined. I'm not a legislator like you are, but let me throw this out. A marriage is a union between two non-related, consenting adult people. That definition would ban bigamy, polygamy, polyandry, minors, incest, and animals. I conclude with a letter that my co-pastor and I published in, have published in the Star Tribune Letters to the Editor, February 25th. President Bush and others say they are saving the institution of marriage, but we've yet to hear a reasonable explanation of how denying two people the right to formalize their commitment to love one another till death do us part can possibly harm the institution of marriage. Let's be clear when we say we are opposed to same-sex marriages. That means we don't want to support two people who are trying to live a committed relationship. We don't want to grant them legal rights that will provide a more stable foundation from which to raise children. We would prefer to deny the relationship of two individuals who, like heterosexuals, are simply committed to going through life with another person who loves them and whom they love. If your religious institution chooses not to marry same-sex couples, following the counseling and support provided to any couple, our church could. It has something to do with seeking to embody the limitless love of God, kind of like Jesus. I would be more than willing to talk to any of you in person or by phone if you think that would be helpful. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Reverend. And that brings us to 32 minutes of public testimony on both sides of the issue, so we will now move into the committee discussion phase of today's hearing. We have before us today two amendments. Who moves the A1 amendment? Seeing none, I'll ask if anyone would like to move the A2 amendment. Seeing none, Chair will recognize Representative Lippman for questions.
I was wondering if Professor Morrison is still in the audience. I've lost track of her.
Professor Morrison.
I'm sorry, she had to leave.
Is Mr. Sikora? Okay. Would you be willing to try, Mr. Gruden? I do have a legal question. I'm just... Oh, that would be grand.
Good afternoon, sir. Representative Lippman.
Could I just get the witness's name, only because I...
Absolutely. Sir, if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Phil Duran. Last name is D-U-R-A-N.
Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Duran, I just have a couple of quick questions. Would you agree with me that the voters who approved this document in 1857 didn't understand that the Due Process Clause in Article 1, Section 7 authorized same-sex marriage?
Mr. Duran.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman, I'm not certain what the voters of 1857 had in mind.
Okay.
About any issue.
Representative Lippman.
Okay, which obviates the second question. My third and final question is, if a suit like Goodridge versus the Department of Health in the Massachusetts case were filed in Minnesota, would you agree with me that it's not clear that the state courts would enforce the understanding of the voters who originally approved this document, the 1857 understanding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitman, I believe the court's role is to interpret the Constitution. I'm in no position to predict how the Minnesota Supreme Court would rule on anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DeGrand.
Thank you, Representative Lippman. Are there any other questions for any of the testifiers today? Is there any committee discussion with respect to House File 2798? Representative Biernat.
Mr. Chair, just a question to the author. Representative Holberg, on your bill, in lines 11, 12, and 13, you talk about shall not be recognized as a marriage or its legal equivalent. What is your intent by that particular language?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biernat, the intent of the language is that whether a relationship be called a civil union or any other name that you give it, that unless it is a relationship between one man and one woman, it would not be recognized as a legal equivalent to marriage in the state of Minnesota. However, it would allow for situations similar to Hawaii, in which they have set up contractual relationships through state law that are some subset of the marriage rights.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Burnett.
Would that include some form of civil union similar to Vermont, because Vermont and Hawaii are relatively similar in terms of their approach to make sure that the benefits that one derives from marriage would also be available for those who cannot be enter into marriage?
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burnett, it's my understanding that there is a difference between what is in place in Hawaii versus what is in place in Vermont, and that in Vermont there is equality between civil unions and marriage, with the exception of the name of the contract and whether it involves a same-sex partnership versus one man and one woman. I might have to phone a friend here with Professor Collette, but my understanding of the statutory contract in the state of Hawaii, use the right term here, it's a reciprocal beneficiary is the title of the contract in Hawaii, and it is not based on a sexual relationship, but rather is open to adults that are willing to enter into a contract that regulates both responsibilities and rights. And in fact, one of the situations that was explained to me that's using this type of contracting is two widows sharing a home, financial support for each other, etc. However, currently, according to the records for the state of Hawaii, there is some move in the state of Hawaii to enact civil unions. And if you hang on just a second, I can get more detail on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Burnett.
One more follow-up. So if you don't really object to some kind of equivalency, and you as chair of the committee, would you be able to hear a bill that I would introduce this year to give the equivalent benefits to these other relationships?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burnett, the issue of equivalency addressed in my bill is that no other relationship could be its legal equivalent.
So, Mr. Chair, Madam
Representative Burnett,
would you be able to hear such a bill on Friday of this week?
Mr. Chair, point of order, what precisely bill are we on right now?
Representative Smith, the file before us is House File 2798. Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burnett, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. If you are asking whether we have time for a bill on Friday, I believe we are up to 20-some bills. But if your question is whether I would support a bill that would allow for equal benefits and call it civil union or whatever, I would not support that measure.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Burnett, we have before us an amendment 04-, excuse me, I don't know if that's
correct. It would be an oral amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Be an oral amendment, Chair recognizes Representative Lippman.
I think Professor Morrison made a good point about the doctrine of multifariousness, in that we've mentioned legal equivalent on lines 12 and 13, but it's not mentioned on lines 18 and 19. And we shouldn't have, it should be mentioned in both places. So as a matter of drafting, I guess I would move, this as an oral amendment. I've written it out and had it copied following Professor Morrison's testimony, and would urge consideration of that.
Is there any question to the Whitman oral amendment? Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbert.
I'd like a copy of the amendment, please.
Forgive me.
That would be helpful.
Very helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll give the author a moment to review Representative Lippman's oral amendment. Are there any questions or any discussion of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, if Representative Lippman could explain the reason why he's proposing this.
Certainly. Representative Lippman, to your amendment.
Sure. I think Professor Morrison, in her testimony, suggested that there might be a later challenge to this language if the proposition on 12 and 13 was not presented to the voters because only lines, or because the lines 17 through 19 would be presented to the voters, that if the matter of legal equivalency wasn't presented to the voters, that there might be some procedural defect in the legislation. So I think the point is a fair one. So on the fly, I've written down a way to rephrase lines 18 and 19 so as to cure that, I think, unintended procedural drafting error. Perhaps error is too strong. Oversight.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think given that the audience head doesn't have a copy of this, if somebody could just read.
May I do a dramatic reading, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Littman.
Thank you. Delete lines 18 and 19 of the bill and insert that marriage or its legal equivalent is limited to the union of one man and one woman, question mark.
Ms. McKnight, have you had a chance to review the amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes, it fits the placement is correct. It fits.
Thank you. Any question or discussion of the Littman Amendment? Representative Biernat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Littman, I wonder if you could explain what legal equivalent means.
Representative Littman.
As I understand, House File 2798 is introduced. One could have a civil union or some other suggestion, some other nomenclature, which would have all of the equivalent rights of and benefits of marriage. I believe one of the witnesses testified that there were nearly 1,000 recognized rights and benefits which accrue to marriage. So I think that marriage or its legal equivalent would, by some other name. So the question is the bundle of rights that we understand as accruing to marriage limited to the union of one man and one woman?
Representative Biernat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Littman, well, then the issue really becomes, and you mentioned the 1857 Constitution, but we also have the United States Constitution, which has an equal protection clause that was adopted in 1868 after the Minnesota Constitution. And that has a, because what you're stating here is that even in the future, you're going to deny these specific benefits to one group of people, but yet bestow it on another group of people. And so wouldn't that fly in the face of the Equal Protection Clause? And isn't that the reason of the challenge in both Hawaii and Massachusetts, that there's a fundamental unfairness when you're saying one group gets X amount of benefits and the other group cannot ever get these kind of benefits, and we're going to put it in our Constitution? The challenge will still be there. What are you solving?
Representative Littman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biernat, I think we're solving a couple of things, if I might, incrementally. And one is that marriage laws and its definition are traditionally the province of the states and not the federal government. And two, as I read Lawrence versus Texas, the Equal Protection Clause would not be applied in that way. Apparently, there was a substantive due process right to be free from criminal prosecutions for sodomy, but the majority in Lawrence versus Texas seemed to specifically disclaim that either the due process or your Equal Protection Clause could be read in such a way as to oblige same-sex marriage. I take the Supreme Court at their word. I don't agree with the decision in Lawrence versus Texas. I don't read the Constitution in the same way that the court majority does, but even that notwithstanding, they disclaim that the federal Constitution isn't a basis for equal protection guarantee for same union or same sex unions. Okay, so I think that there is a gap, a vacuum here. What I'm trying to do with this amendment and with my co-authorship is to say that until the 1857 understanding of what marriage was about and the Due Process Clause was about is changed by either statute or amendment, this amendment should be on, that this should be part of the constitutional law, so that we can, by court fiat, decide what to change that original understanding of the institution of marriage or what the Due Process Clause means. That's I think the danger here.
Representative Biernat.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to continue the discussion further, but it still does provide for the argument that this is a blatant discrimination because it does provide benefits to one and not the other, and the U.S. Supreme Court was not hesitant to step into state marriage law as it did in Loving versus Virginia and to outlaw same or different race marriages. And I think what we're doing here is creating a situation in which we are denying a lot of people certain benefits. Maybe the alternative, and maybe you'd want to work on this, is to deny benefits to those who are married.
Representative Lippman.
Well, Chairman De La Forest, Representative Biernat, I couldn't disagree more that the Loving case, Loving versus Virginia, is on point. Mr. Groot, in I believe last month, testified that she doesn't believe, in her view, that the Minnesota's marriage laws were advanced or enacted with a discriminatory purpose in mind. That was the case in Loving. That's not our case here. I mean, even the opposition, the lead of the opposition, agrees that there wasn't a discriminatory purpose behind the marriage laws. And so Loving versus Virginia doesn't apply. It's a canard to even suggest that. And the analysis falls down from there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Chairman, thank you. A question of the author of the amendment. Representative Whitman, do you view the proposed oral amendment as an attempt to find compromise language?
Representative Lippman.
Forgive me, I was having a colloquy with Senator Bachman. Would you mind repeating the question?
Representative Smith.
I will, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lippman, I directed my question to you, and I'll restate it now, and that is, do you view the language in your oral amendment as compromised language?
Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't think that it is compromised. I'm trying to reflect the intent of Representative Holberg and to solve the drafting error that legal equivalency was mentioned in lines 12 and 13, but not in lines 18 and 19. I think in order so that the same question that we enact or put on the ballot, it is reflected on the ballot, is the reason for the amendment. It has to be in both pieces.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith
and Representative Whitman, your proposed language, if it's not compromise language, then does it have the same intent and the same meaning as the words that it replaces, that the union of one man and one woman will be recognized as a marriage in Minnesota?
Representative Lippman.
I do believe it does have that intention, and also it would extend that same definition to legal equivalency, which is the proposition that the legislature would approve on lines 12 and 13.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, that to expand my attempt to understand your language, if you will, so that then your view is, if this language is adopted, this amendment is adopted, that not only would a union of one man and one woman be a marriage, but that the legislature could adopt some additional union to constitute.
Representative Lippman.
If this amendment were enacted, the legal equivalency to marriage could not be enacted by the legislature on its own as an ordinary statute. It would require the legal equivalency of marriage or a definition of marriage that doesn't include one man and one woman would oblige first a constitutional change before the legislature would have that power.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize.
Representative Smith. But
this requires one additional question so I can understand. So then, Mr. Representative Lippman, your proposed language could mean the possibility where the union, that where marriage could be defined somewhere down the road as something other than or to be more than just only a union of one man and one woman.
Representative Lippman.
Chairman De La Forest, Representative Smith, it would oblige a constitutional amendment first to give the legislature that power.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, the answer is yes.
Representative Lippman.
Not without a constitutional amendment. Yes, if other events which I don't know about happen. This, I think, would this language would prevent a court from redefining the state constitution.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, I heard a yes with a lot of other words plugged in thereafter. Thank you.
We'll give, we have before us the Lippman Amendment. We'll give Representative Holberg the final word before we vote on this amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee, I think that the Lippman Amendment attempts to be more straightforward with the voters. Representative Clark came to me with some concerns yesterday. I talked to a few individuals. Unfortunately, Ms. McKnight was not available this morning, and I couldn't get to her office till I think approximately 12:30, so had some discussions with some individuals. I think the amendment before us at this time addresses the concern of the ballot question more accurately reflecting the constitutional amendment language. And so I'm not, as you guys know, I'm not good at all the legal terms, but in simple terms, I support the amendment, and I think it's something we need to do to keep faith with the voters.
Briefly, Representative Burrell.
I may have to apologize up front, Mr. Chair. I may not be able to be that brief. My question, and it could be to Representative Smith, Representative Biernat, Representative Lippman, or Representative Holberg. Because I'm not the lawyer on the committee, I have to have this explained a little further, and I think Representative Smith was a little confused. My question is, adopting this amendment and enacting this bill, does it prohibit the legislature from adopting some other, call it a civil union, that I believe the testimony was 1,138 benefits for marriage? Would this prohibit us from the legislature from adopting some other civil union that would say give only 800 of those benefits to people in a civil union instead of all 1,138? It wouldn't be equivalent, but it would be something less than equivalent. If someone could answer that for me, I'd sure appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Members, at this time, the chair is going to call a recess, subject to recall at the discretion of the chair. Representative Biernat, it's my intention that this committee will recess for approximately 20 minutes. Tell them this committee stands in recess.
I think it makes sense.
See, that's why I didn't want to sit, because what that did is created what he just did.
Yeah.
Right.
20 minutes?
Did you have a question?
20 minutes? Okay, I'm so
pissed. I don't think so, but
no.
I think
but it is. But it's yeah. We can't deal with it. Social Security, we can't deal with all the other issues. Better than that.
Thanks for your notes.
There was a hearing before the first hearing.
Right.
It will go before the House. Thank you. Thank you. very well-run committee, Mr. Chair. Now, Howard, if only we got this bill in the Senate.
You don't expect that?
Oh, I have no reason to expect that.
We're going to recess for dinner.
No,
okay.
I can kind of see what he was talking about, but then switch back.
Is everyone dispersed and gone home?
Folks, if you take your seats, we'll reconvene the meeting.
Okay.
Chair recognizes Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I got to get my paperwork out here. I apologize for the delay. I believe that after some consultation with any of the esteemed attorneys on the committee that we need to make one oral amendment to the Littman Amendment, and it will be a friendly amendment, and I think Representative Smith wanted to do that.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, if this is the correct procedure, I am looking at the written copy of the oral amendment, and I would move the inclusion of the word on the last line only between the words to and the, so it would read, excuse me, yes, to.
Thank you. Representative Whitman. Union.
Yes, that is a friendly amendment. You know, I'd be glad to accept that and incorporate that into my motion.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I hear rumbling behind me, so I think what I'll do is I will read what the language would entail, as I understand it. Ms. McKnight's back as well, so that will help with this issue. And so the amendment would then read, lines 18, 19, and insert, quote, that marriage or its legal equivalent is limited to only the union of one man and one woman.
Okay. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members to House File 2798, is there any further discussion of the bill? Representative Burrell.
Mr. Chairman, I would just move for a roll call vote.
A roll call vote has been requested. When we vote, the clerk will call the roll. Yeah, right. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Holberg.
I would renew my motion that House File 2798, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Holberg.
Aye.
Representative De La Forest.
Aye.
Representative Atkins.
No.
Representative Biernat.
No.
Representative Burrell.
Aye.
Representative Coles.
Aye.
Representative Latz.
No.
Representative Lippman.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Swenson.
Aye.
Representative Wardlow.
Aye.
There are 8 ayes and 4 nays. Therefore, the motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted. Ladies and gentlemen, the House Civil Law Committee will stand in recess for approximately 60 minutes for a dinner break, and then we will proceed in about 60 minutes with the rest of the agenda for this evening.
Civil Law Committee meeting for March 8th. I see Representative Harder is in the audience. So you're up first if you'd like to step to the podium. And I will move House File 1732, and that's going to go to Judiciary, Policy, and Finance is what I have in my materials. Is that correct, Representative Harder?
That's what I understand, is that it goes on to Judiciary, oh. Madam Chair.
All right, if you'll explain your bill for the committee, please.
Well, House File 1732 addresses livestock production issues and health and welfare. Livestock is becoming more concentrated and housed in larger numbers. Animal health practices for large groups of animals are very, very important as spread of disease is more possible in larger groups. Security issues are more prevalent than ever in the last several years as we strive to protect our food supply and focus on food safety. Agricultural investments in livestock production are very significant, and there is a need for protection from intrusion of unauthorized people into production agriculture livestock facilities. Such trespassing could spread disease and have significant economic ramifications. House File 1732 addresses 2 issues, and one is the potential for exposing domestic animals to disease, provides for a gross misdemeanor for a person who intentionally exposes domestic animals to an animal disease, and also addresses trespass on agricultural land. A person who intentionally and without permission enters a livestock area that has been properly posted as a biosecurity area is guilty of a misdemeanor, and the bill lays out minimum requirements for properly posting the property. And also provides an exception from trespass law for state and county regulatory agents conducting inspection that was added in the Agriculture Committee. So I have some witnesses to comment on the bill, Madam Chair. First of all, someone from the Board of Animal Health to talk about the economic impact and the disease issues.
All right. Thank you. Rips, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm a veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health. And the board certainly supports this bill. The bill would provide some protection to livestock producers against the threat of bioterrorism, whether it be domestic or foreign. And from my experience, the area that I've worked most closely with is the swine industry in Minnesota over the last 12 or 14 years with the pseudorabies eradication program. And I could use that as an example of the potential risk to our livestock producers. If pseudorabies was reintroduced into Minnesota, we are now free of the disease. It took about 14 years to get rid of this disease at a cost of about $50 million in regulatory costs and probably equal that as producer costs. The pork industry, for example, contributes over $1 billion to the economy in Minnesota each year, and a reintroduction of pseudorabies at this point not only would affect a single farm, but would undoubtedly spread farm to farm, and could literally shut down our swine industry from exporting pigs out of the state. The financial impact of such an event would be devastating, not only to the state, but certainly to the swine industry. And so, you know, there are all kinds of other examples. Foot and mouth disease probably is one of the worst diseases on earth as far as livestock. In Great Britain, over $19 billion was expended to get rid of the disease. And most recently, epizootic Newcastle disease in California, $200 million was spent to eradicate that disease in poultry. So we certainly support the bill and hope that we would never have an intentional introduction of disease into our livestock in Minnesota.
Right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Anderson? All right. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, I do have another witness. I wonder if we could call him forward.
Representative Harder, if there are no questions on the bill and given the lateness of the hour and our schedule, I think if that's okay with you, we'll just keep moving.
That's fine.
Here. Members, are there any questions for Representative Harder? Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, I'm not trying to extend the night any longer, but just a quick question, Representative Harder. Would this apply to, like, mink and other species that, you know, may be raised by farmers across Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative Burrell, the bill indicates any domesticated animal. So I'm not familiar with mink being included in this. That's a fair question to ask. But we're focusing on most likely. Oh, we may have further insight into this. It may include animals being commercially produced. Staff is indicating that if it's for commercial production, it would be covered. On page 2 of the first engrossment, line 10.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Harder, I'm sorry. Is Mr. Gramish here? It looks as though he's might be a constituent that came here all the way from Nicola County.
Yeah.
Is that who you wanted to testify?
Yeah.
Sir, I'm sorry. Usually when members of the public want to testify, we let them testify. Lobbyists and bureaucrats, we sometimes cut them off, but certainly if you came all the way to testify on this bill, we'd like to give you that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Grumish. I'm an independent hog farmer in Nicollet County, and I'm the third generation hog producer on my farm. And I would just like to share something that happened this last year. I'm here today because of an incident that happened this past year. It illustrates the need for the passage of the House File 1732. The situation that faced my family could have had serious consequences to my animals' health and well-being and to my ability to remain economically viable. Trespassing onto livestock farms can cause serious animal welfare risks to a producer's swine herd, in addition to economic devastation that independent farmers such as myself would have great difficulty recovering from. The incident involved trespassing onto our farm property by individuals who wanted to photograph our dead animals. The website of the group that the individuals represented states their mission was eliminating animal agriculture. The main problem I see with strangers wandering onto my livestock farm is the potential spread of livestock diseases both into my herd or dragging disease from my herd to another farm. These individuals did not recognize the potential disaster they could have caused by entering and exiting various livestock farms, or did they know the ramification and want to cause serious injury to my animals. From the information we gathered that day, they had plans to visit other hog farms in the area. It was last April we had an incident where there were three individuals dressed in black in the early evening. My neighbor observed them trespassing on my property. he called it to my attention, and we came to find out that they were taking pictures of the deceased animals that were waiting for rendering services to come and pick up the following day. After discussion with them, it was pointed out that the people were animal rights activists. At that time, we called the sheriff's department. Besides being equipped with cameras, they also had a global positioning device with the coordinates of our farm along with other farms locked into it. And after lengthy discussion by the deputy sheriff with the trespassers and also with us, it was unclear as to whether they could be charged with anything or not because the trespassing law was so unclear. So it was agreed upon that they would destroy the pictures and that they would blank out the GPS system. They also received a strong warning as to never be caught in Nicola County doing this type of criminal activity again. But it was about a week later, after this incident, I had emailed fellow pork producers in the area. And it was, I believe, the following week when a pork producer gave me a call and said that the description of the car and the persons driving it were also seen in the next county over, which is Brown County, doing the same thing. So this was not an isolated incident. So for these reasons, I would strongly urge the passage of this House File 1732.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gramish. Are there any questions for Mr. Gramish? Thank you very much for taking time to come to the committee. Any additional questions for Representative Harder? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1732 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative Harder. The next item on the agenda is Representative Knobloch's bill. Going to get him. Representative Hughes not here. Johnson, Mullery. She a jerk.
I'll go with Hughes. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative Hughes' witness here is available. But perhaps she could start walking us through the bill if that, can we get him?
It looks like his bill's pretty lengthy. And I think Knobloch should be short. Let's see if we see a rep come quick. They're going to get here. They want to go there. Oh, here's Representative Mullery. It's your lucky day. Members, we'll take up House File 2410. And on my information, Representative Mullery, I show that you're supposed to go to Commerce with a question mark. So if you'd please advise me where you'd like your bill to go, I'd be happy to make that motion.
Madam Chair, my understanding, I don't think I had asked Mr. Pender initially if it should go initially to Commerce. And he said, no, this is really a civil law matter. And so that's why it's here. And I don't think it has to go to Commerce. I haven't heard anything on that.
All right. Like I said, I have Commerce and a question mark. So I'll move House File 2410 to be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Mullery, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to explain your bill and introduce your witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is a bill that arose. Lynn Salger, a constituent of mine presently, called me. He's a former mayor of Watertown and moved to God's Country, North Minneapolis. immediately ran into a problem. And we straightened it out by talking to the developer who was still in charge of the Homeowners Association by explaining the fact that we would be going for a law on it, and also that we wondered if he wanted to be in the newspapers about this. And he had restricted the owners of the townhomes in, or not townhomes, but they're single-family homes, but in a homeowners association, and he had restricted the usual language that you can't make changes and things to the outsides. However, he also applied it to flags, and we feel that people should be entitled to fly flags in a reasonable manner on the outside of their house. And upon looking into it after Mr. Sauger contacted me, several states have had this issue, and all of them have then passed laws allowing homeowners to fly flags. And so, in fact, a lot of them just have it across the board that it applies to condos and everything else, and all apartments. But we decided not to go that far and limit it to with an exception as far as the use of a bracket for display to exclude multi-unit rental properties, that they don't have to put the bracket for display on there on the outside. And basically that's what the bill is. And then it says if a owner wrongfully prevents a tenant from flying a flag, that the tenant can get their attorney's fees for going to court to enforce their rights under this statute. And it's every state has slightly different language, but it's they're all basically the same as this. Right. And I don't know if you're in a hurry, if you want Mr. Sauger. And we also have a person, the American Legion, wanted to testify on behalf of the bill also.
All right.
In support of it.
Sir, if you'd state your name for the record and your testimony. Yes.
My name is Lynn Hauger. It's H-A-U-G-E-R. I live at 5147 Humboldt Avenue North in Minneapolis. And we're delighted to be in Minneapolis area. But this was a problem, and with respect to displaying of the American flag. So I appreciated Representative Mallory getting involved in introducing this bill. And I would ask that the committee would be in support of this bill. I find that this is an onerous thing of homeowners associations to prevent homeowners from displaying the American flag. And where's the patriotism in this particular situation? So I would ask that you would support the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Sir, if you'd like to testify, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am Richard Anglim, the last name is spelled A-N-G-L-I-M, and I represent the 5th District of the Department of Minnesota. And we most assuredly support this bill. We believe that homeowners should be able to display their patriotism. I can't think of anything worse than a homeowner being prevented from doing that, especially the flying of an American flag. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witnesses? Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, again, I apologize. I'm not trying to stretch out the meeting, but Mr. Haugen, I do have a question. Is it a question of that the flying of any flag was not allowed, or that flying of a certain size American flag was okay and then a bigger one was not acceptable?
No, that was not Representative Burrell.
Sorry, I just have to recognize. It's just.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I apologize, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, Representative Burrell. In this particular situation, I will quote what the president of the association and developer of the project said. He is denying any request of any sort regarding a flagpole bracket, or any other type of carrier to fly any type of flag. It is his position that as long as he is president of the association, he does not want to make any type of precedence in regards to this type of situation. So he was denying any type of flag, banner, poster, what have you. And I had asked permission, knowing that he was not going to allow a flagpole. He had addressed that situation at our annual meeting. And so I had called and had put forward a letter of request to place a bracket on the side of my house and to fly a flag 3x4, 3x5, what have you, and he denied that request.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Gentlemen, thank you for
thank
coming
you.
To testify. I see Mr. Vanasek would like to testify on this bill as well. Again, gentlemen, thank you for coming this evening.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Vanosik, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Jack Horner really wished that he could be here tonight.
To oppose the
just
flag.
Just speak in opposition of flying the American flag, right? Okay.
But he's across, not ready for office again.
Yes, but I am not ready for office again. Our concern with the bill, we're not here to speak against displaying the American flag, but our concern with the bill is that what it could lead to in future years if you get requests from folks coming back wanting to be able to display other artifacts that would either display their religious or political beliefs to be able to express them in other ways. We want to try to make sure that that our properties are appealing to those that pass by as well as to all of the tenants that that reside in those properties. So again, it's difficult to say that in this particular instance that this is not the right thing to do, but it's just where this might lead to in terms of requests that might come before you in future years.
Thank you, and I'm so glad you weren't going to testify against flying the American flag. Are there any questions for Mr. Vanosik? Thank you very much. Any additional questions for the author? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess there's another gentleman that would like to speak on this bill. So if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chairperson, my name is Tom Bray, B-R-A-Y. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Briggs & Morgan. For the past 15 years, I've been a member of the Minnesota Real Property Council's Committee on the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, sometimes referred to as MCIOWA, Minnesota Statutes Chapter 515B. I've been asked by the chairman of that committee, David Ide, to appear tonight and to pass on to you some comments and concerns that the committee has about this proposed bill. Just a little background on the committee. The committee is composed of 5 to 10 real estate attorneys who represent a broad range of persons with interests in condominiums and townhomes. We have attorneys who represent developers, attorneys who represent associations, attorneys who represent title companies, and I think it's fair to say all the members of the committee have at some time or another represented individual homeowners as well. Our primary concern with the proposed bill is the language in Section 5 and Section 8 of the bill, which would prevent a homeowner association that is foreclosing its lien for delinquent assessments from recovering from the delinquent party its full attorney's fees, and would instead subject the association to the same limitation on attorney's fees that mortgagees are subject to under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 582.01. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 582.01 establishes a schedule, so to speak, of attorney's fees that can be recovered in a mortgage foreclosure action, and that amount is based in part on the amount of the lien. If you apply that statute to a typical homeowners association lien, it would limit the fees that could be recovered to approximately $150. The short answer is that if you do not allow the association to recover the cost of foreclosing an association lien from the delinquent homeowner, then it's that delinquent homeowner's neighbors who have to bear that cost.
Thank you. Representative Mallory, can you explain?
Madam Chair.
That's all right.
It's too late. First of all, I don't think Section 5 is their issue, because all that does is say that
subsection F of Section 5.
Well, but that's just complying with the I think that's, maybe he used the wrong reference there.
Representative Mallory, my understanding is this concern was located on page 5, line 30, if I've got it wrong. Mr. Bray, please correct me.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I didn't see that reference. Madam Chair, this is something that I didn't realize had been included in this bill by Mr. Pender. We had been talking about this also because he, I brought this up, and he also has heard from a number of legislators about the excessive attorney's fees in the range of $10,000 and things like that on these foreclosures. And I think that I think we should basically agree to look at this over the interim, that issue, because it really isn't just related to the flag issue. And I think this is something that we should work with the Bar Association. I think it's a very definite thing we have to work on and start limiting, I hate to say that, but limiting attorney's fees.
Representative Mulready, I don't think you need to go any further. I would happily move an oral amendment to delete the comma, page 5, line 29, delete the comma, line 30, delete everything that's underlined.
And I think,
Madam Chair?
Mr. Bray.
There's also text that needs to be reinserted at,
if we delete.
Starting on 12.7 through 12.11.
Madam Chair, if we delete Section 6 of the bill, then you don't have to get into that. In fact, I think if you delete Section 5 and 8, there's no need for.
Okay.
I don't think you need to get into that.
Set over. I'm going to move to delete Sections 5 and 8. Any opposition to that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Are there any additional questions or concerns?
Madam Chair, our committee did have some comments on the flag provisions of the bill as well.
All right.
The areas where we had some concerns is the language which would allow, in a multifamily context, would allow the owners to mount brackets on the exterior of the building. It has been limited with respect to multifamily rental property, but not with respect to multifamily condominium or townhome property. The concern there is it is the association that is responsible for the maintenance of the exterior of the buildings, typically, and allowing individual unit owners to mount brackets can result in, if it's a brick building, and damage to the tuck pointing, if it's a vinyl-sided building, to perforations in the siding that can then allow moisture to penetrate behind the siding, causing mold issues. So there is some concern with that language in terms of the mounting brackets. There is also a concern.
If I might, did you express your concerns to Representative Mulready before this evening?
No, I have not. I was just called today to ask if I could appear. We got the bill late last week.
Representative Mulready, if I might, it's getting late, and we could take a lot of testimony on this, or if you would be so kind, I would like to lay this on the table, suggest that you two go to the hallway, see if you can figure out some resolution to this, and you can come back up after the next bill. With that, I'm going to lay House File 2410 on the table, and we'll take it up after we complete the next bill. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I've been running around between different committee rooms.
It's that kind of evening. Alicia, would you mind taking the piles of emails off of the stand here and bringing them over to the other end of the table? Thank you very much. Representative Pugh, if you'd like to move your bill.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1983 be recommended to pass and sent on to the General Register. Is this going?
Representative Pugh, in my documents I have, you're going to State Government Finance.
Okay, that may be. I don't know that there's a finance consequence at all, but they asked for
it. Mr. Bearden informs me that they have requested to take a peek at it. So.
Okay.
If you would like to present your bill, we're paying special attention to those sections that apply to the Civil Law Committee.
Madam Chair, House Bill 1983 is a revision to the Uniform Commercial Code. It's addressed primarily to Article 7. There are some changes in other articles, but primarily in Article 7, and it reflects a change in commerce. It deals with warehouse receipts, bills of lading and trucking and warehousing. This section of the Uniform Commercial Code has not been addressed in large part since 1951, I believe, the date of its adoption. But a lot has changed in the way we do commerce since that time, particularly the use of electronic means to transfer information. And the majority of the changes made to this bill reflect that change in the business world. And I have with me today Professor Linda Rusch, who is an expert in this area, and she can present the substantive changes to the law and to the bill, and also to answer any questions that members may have.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Professor. And just for our information, was there anybody that opposed your bill in the Commerce Committee?
There was not, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Rusch. I'm a professor at Hamline University School of Law, and I was on the drafting committee that prepared this bill for the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws and the American Law Institute. So I have participated in the preparation of this at the national level. And the bill, in terms of Article 7, basically does three or four major things, and I can go into as much detail as the committee would like, but the high spots are that it creates electronic documents of title, which right now documents of title have to be in paper form basically to have legal effect, and it creates electronic documents of title that lets people have documents of title in databases or in electronic form, which really cuts down the cost of transportation and storage and responds to changes in the industry. The federal government has allowed electronic warehouse receipts in certain commodities for years and has had good experience there. Electronic bills of lading in terms of shipping have been used internationally, and so this is just catching up to where the industry is going. The second major change it responds to is deregulation in the areas of transportation and storage of goods, and so it responds to the fact that the ICC and tariff system no longer exists. The third major change is the UCC has undergone revisions over the course of the past decade, and this catches up Article 7 to mesh with the rest of the Uniform Commercial Code, so there's cross-reference changes and some terminology changes. And then finally, it creates some certainty where some case law had created uncertainty in terms of how certain rights and obligations were as between claimants to the goods in if there was a priority dispute. So it has some clarifying changes there. The other changes are in Article 1, which again is to recognize electronic commerce and to catch up Article 1 to the rest of the revisions of the UCC. That's the high spots.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak in opposition to this bill? Are there any members of the committee that have any questions of the bill author or its witness? Representative Burnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. Professor Rusch, is this identical to the national model? Is this almost identical, or are there any kind of changes that Minnesota's adopted?
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative? As to Article 7, it's identical to the national model. As to Article 1, it is not identical to the national model in one section, 1301. The choice of law provision at the national level has proven very controversial. And so we, in conversations with the bar and other interested constituents in Minnesota, have decided to retain the old choice of law provision from former Article 1 and insert it into the 1301 slot. So it has. We have not changed the choice of law provision, which has gotten controversy at the national level.
Madam Chair, I should follow up on that as well. I know initially when this bill was introduced, there was some question about whether which version we had used for this section, and we did use the. We retained the version we had before. We did not attempt the controversial version.
Okay. Any additional questions? Representative Pugh, Mr. Virden reviewed his bill file on this and thinks we should send you to the floor. So if you'd like to amend and renew your motion.
I would amend my motion that it be House File 1983 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Could somebody step out and see if Representative Mullery is ready? I promised him we'd take his bill back up if he She's okay with you if I go.
They're not ready.
All right. Representative Johnson, if you'd like to step to the stand, we're going to take your bill up. So it appears that Mr. Mullery, or Representative Mullery, is not quite ready. I will move House File 1986 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, K-12 Finance it needs to go to.
Oh. So moved.
Thank you.
K-12 Finance. Welcome to the committee. If you'd explain your bill, would you like me to move the 1067 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss it?
Yes, please, Madam Chair, and I also have a small oral amendment of a mistake that's in there.
And would that amendment be to, the oral amendment be to the amendment or the
no,
bill itself?
Okay. To the bill itself.
Members, I'm going to move the 1067 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss the bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The 1067 amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Johnson, if you would point us to the page and line of the other change, please.
Page 8. It's actually two changes. Line 30, there's a comma after the word school. It reads school, comma, district. That shouldn't be there. It should just read school district, so delete the comma. And on line 33, after the word transfer, second from the end, we need to add four words, data that are not. We simply had it backwards. We were referring to directory information. It should be data that are not directory information.
Okay, members, that would be page 8, line 30, after the first word, school, delete the comma. Line 33, after the word transfer, add data that are not. Any questions about the amendment? Do you have that? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The oral amendment is adopted. Now, you should have the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think everyone knows what this is. It is the Governor's Initiative regarding driver's license and truancy, and essentially it provides that students who are excessively absent from school can lose their driver's license. I will not go through my whole spiel because we're going to hit two education committees with this, but in a nutshell, I will outline what the bill says. First of all, it has an opt-out provision, so school boards, school districts do not have to be part of this. They simply need to, by a majority vote of their board, opt out of this. But for those school districts that choose to be in this plan, it provides that students who are 16 or 17 years old, in order to obtain their driver's license, along with everything else that they currently have to do, they must also now present a certificate of school attendance. And the certificate shows that the student is enrolled in attending school and is not absent without valid excuse one or more class periods on 7 days within a single school year. Consistent with district policy, we've left some wiggle room in there for certain school districts that allow for more than 7 days. But the 7 day definition actually comes from current law regarding truancy. If a student's license is suspended, it can be reinstated in one of three ways. Number one, once the student turns 18, the license would be automatically reinstated. If an expulsion has occurred and that expulsion is reversed, the driver's license would be reinstated. Or either 120 days after the department's cancellation notice, so 4 months later, or the end of the semester when the child returns to school, whichever is later. There is a hardship waiver provision in the bill in which the superintendent of that particular school district would appoint an appeals committee. That appeals committee would have a hearing, make a recommendation to the superintendent, and the superintendent then would make a final decision on whether a hardship waiver should be granted to a student who has lost his or her license. And there's also a procedure for notifying parents once a child is defined as a continuing truant under the law, which I believe is 3 days absent without excuse. A notification would be given to the parent or parents of that child, telling them of the risk of the child losing his or her driver's privileges.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Johnson? Representative Swenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson. And I was gone, so I don't know if you've had any other testimony, but I was just wondering if the School Board Association has expressed any views on this bill. And I don't know if there's anybody here from them. But Of course, I understand this is going to go on to education committees too, but I just wondered if there was, if they had a position on it.
Representative Swenson, the bill is going to K-12 finance, yes, and the School Board Association has not testified yet. Representative Johnson.
Representative Swenson, I believe there is someone here from the School Board Association, unless she has left. But they had some concerns. Grace Schwab talked to me. She had some concerns about the hardship waivers. I think we worked them out, but I also told her that we could discuss it more before K-12 finance.
Any additional questions? Representative Biernat.
Madam, just a comment, because I carried a similar bill years ago, but what I don't like about this bill is the opt-out provision. It just seems like Lakeville could have a take away the driver's license, Edina would not. And it just seems like there's a real inconsistency here and a real unfairness depending on what district you live. And at the same time, a parent already has this power to deny a person to have a child, have a driver's license. So I think we're stepping into an area that the parents really have. But more importantly, it's just going to lead to a lot of inconsistency from school district to school district. So I think that makes it kind of a bad bill.
Madam Chair?
Representative Johnson.
Representative Biernat, I think that's a fair criticism that the opt-out, I mean, there are pluses and minuses to it. Bottom line is there was a concern about local control and some school districts saying they would prefer not to do this, and this was the solution.
President Johnson, I have a question, and I haven't read your bill. I apologize for that. But the determination of truant, it's my understanding that different schools have policies on absences that they will deem what excused or non-excused. In some districts, vacations can be excused, and in other districts it can't. How does that work with this bill?
Madam Chair, we leave that up to the local school district as it is currently under the law. The definition says without excuse, but I don't believe it gives any definition as to what an excuse is, and we are maintaining that standard.
So if I might, just for clarification purposes, you said up to one class period in seven times.
That's
so right. If, in fact, my school district says family vacations are unexcused, and I've got a wonderful trip planned for someplace warm and, you know, 5 days, and then my child is late 2 days and doesn't get a note from me, and he has no excuse other than he slept in, then he would be subject to this provision. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Greg Marcus, Minnesota Department of Education. Depending upon if your District A decided to participate in this policy, B had a local attendance policy that said that they wanted to use 7 days as the cutoff as opposed to what some districts have told us, namely that they like the 7 days in state law as the hammer, and then they use their own district discretion to say one more day. We'll give you one, or we'll give you two more days, and then we're calling, you know, we're calling in the troops. We'll get DPS or whatever. If your district did not have such a policy, but rather was going with just the 7 days that's currently in law, and if they decided to say no to family vacations as an excused reason to be absent, then if those three things were true, then that student could be at risk. Yes.
And just for clarification purposes then, would a district be able to set a school district student attendance policy that would treat some absences different relative to the hammer of losing your license versus other issues?
Madam Chair, districts have the discretion to set their attendance policies right now. I think it's a major concern of them that they are equitably constructed and equitably applied, and so I would suspect that they will pay. They have paid much attention to what is fair, what is rational and defensible, and hopefully would continue to use those pre-established policies meeting those criteria.
Madam Chair,
Representative Johnson,
if I could just add something. I would think that if a school board decided to enforce this and they were actually taking away driver's license for kids who went on vacation with their parents, there would be some response to that from the electorate. I would at least hope so. I could be wrong, but that would be my thought, is at the local level, I would hope that that would not be one of the consequences. If it was, it shouldn't last long.
But what I'm looking for, gentlemen, for the record, is that will the school districts have the flexibility of having one tier of unexcused absences for a particular issue, and then certain ones would or would not apply towards yanking a license?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, if you miss one period in one day, that's considered one absence.
But Representative Johnson.
Yeah, that's correct.
But if you miss like three periods in a day, it's still one absence, correct?
That's correct.
Unless they're inconsistent.
What the bill says is one or more periods in a day.
Good.
Madam Chair, I have others who would be happy to testify, but I'm going to wait and see if there are questions that, for example, the Department of Public Safety would need to address.
All right. Are there any additional questions for the bill author's witness? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to House File 1986? Any additional people that would like to speak in favor of 1986? Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And like Representative Johnson, I won't go through my earlier spiel other than to say that the partnership does support this provision. The main rationale being that we think this can give schools and school districts a useful tool to help at least some students stay in school and ultimately to finish school and graduate.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bartholomew? All right. Members, I'll renew my motion that House File 1986, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to K-12 Finance. Any additional questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Representative Mullery, I don't see him yet. Representative Knobloch. Welcome to the committee. If you'd step to the table and present your bill. My understanding is that House File 2002 is going to the general register. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Thank you. I didn't hear you call my name. I was in another conversation. Good evening, Madam Chair, members. House File 2002 is a simple bill that says that a court must take into account the ratio between a damage award and total attorney's fees when dealing with a statute that provides the awarding of attorney fees to a party that has recovered money damages. This bill would make sure that there isn't any kind of an incentive, or at least less of an incentive, for a attorney to potentially drag out a case for the attorney's fees in a case where a statute provides that they have to be awarded or can be awarded, as we have some statutes that do. And this was prompted by a case with the Great River Regional Library, our St. Cloud Area Library in St. Cloud. And here to talk about that case is Neil France, an attorney from St. Cloud who represented the library. And if I can turn it over to Neil, he can give you the specifics.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. France. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Neil Franz. I'm an attorney from St. Cloud with the law firm of Niels, Franz, and Sherhart.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Knobloch. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had the privilege in 1998 and 1999 to represent the Great River Regional Library in defending a human rights action brought by a plaintiff by the name of Janice Hansen, who was an employee of the library. There were other defendants in the case. The regional library is made up of six counties and the city of St. Cloud at that time. They were separately defended and named parties in the lawsuit. The claim brought by Ms. Hansen was based on the Human Rights Act, and the substantial monetary claim that she brought was one for constructive discharge. The claims that she asserted, both at times of mediation, at the time of trial, approached $400,000 for compensatory damages. The defendants, of course, saw that considerably differently. In February of 1999, a court-ordered mediation took place and a substantial collaborative offer was made by the defendants, which was rejected by the plaintiffs. We then moved forward and ended up trying the case for 2 weeks. At the conclusion of the trial, which is only in front of a judge, in this case Richard Jessen of the 7th Judicial District, Stearns County, Judge Jessen awarded nothing on the claim for constructive discharge and awarded compensatory damages of $10,000. Nevertheless, because Minnesota statute, in this case 363.14 subdivision 3, provides that reasonable attorney's fees may be awarded in the discretion of the court, the plaintiff submitted an attorney's fee claim in excess of $120,000. At the defense request and insistence, we objected to the amount of the claim, and the court did give consideration to our request, having the amount of the claimed fees, which came into being after the date of the offer. It was my frustration with the lack of an ability to negotiate effectively with the plaintiff that brought me to take this to the attention of Mr. Knobloch, and I understand Mr. Knobloch, in consulting with House Counsel, has formulated the legislation that is before you today. As an attorney who represented a public body, my objective and my hope by this legislation is that we can find a way to rebalance the negotiating power, because frankly, this case should have been resolved long before the trial. And frankly, there was not, in my judgment, sufficient downside for a plaintiff who, in this case, made a bad decision, causing additional costs to all of the named defendants.
So, Madam Chair, here you have a case where the defendant really doesn't, or the plaintiff really doesn't have that great of a case. The attorney brings it all the way through trial anyway. In the end, the plaintiff wins $10,000, and the plaintiff's attorney is awarded $120,000. And we're just saying, if we had a statute like this in place, attorneys would maybe think a little bit more before they drag something all the way through the court system and took up the court's time. And that's why this bill is before you.
For the record,
Mr. Franz.
Yes. If I could just clarify one thing. The fee claim was $120,000. The award made by the court was $81,615. That was after the court had halved the requested fees after the date of the offer.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Members, are there any questions for Mr. Franz?
Madam Chair.
Representative Burnett.
Madam Chair, then Mr. Franz, then it appears that Judge Jensen did take into account the reasonableness, because he certainly he lowered the attorney's fees, and I think don't judges have a great deal of discretion about this? Because as I look at this bill, I don't know what this bill would really solve, because it just says the judge must take into consideration. Well, how do you know that, and how do you prove that? Does the judge have to make findings of facts? Does he have to spell that out specifically in his ruling? How do you really know that, and what's this going to change?
Mr. Franz.
Yes, thank you. The court, indeed, the statute says it's entirely up to the discretion of the court. There is a United States Supreme Court case that applies to civil rights claims such as this. It includes a number of factors, one of which is the award or the success of the plaintiff. And the court did rely on that, although in my judgment, reluctantly. My objective, and I think Representative Knobloch's objective in drafting this legislation, is to try to highlight that message so that the playing field can be evened earlier.
Representative Burnett. Thank you. Additional questions of the author of his witness? I understand that Mr. Carlson would like to speak in opposition to your bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers to offer some comments on House File 2002. Since at least 1983, the courts have operated, I believe, as Mr. Friends testified, and that is they've operated under a decision called Hensley that awards reasonable attorney's fees that is not exclusively based on the amount of the recovery. And that is specifically done because there are generally important civil and constitutional rights that are being asserted, and simply saying that the award has to be in relationship, the attorney's fee has to be in relationship to the money damages that may be awarded, defeats the purpose of the legislature and Congress in adopting those civil rights protections for us. I'm not aware of the specifics of this particular case, but there are some problems with the language of the bill that that I think are that need to be addressed. And one of them is that it must take it into consideration on line 11, and the problem with that is that we believe people will argue that that is the only consideration that the courts can look at, what the relationship or the reasonableness is between the award and the attorney fee. And secondly, on line 10, it requires that it has to be for a party that has recovered money damages. There are instances where money damages are not awarded, where specific injunctive relief is sought, where this wouldn't come into play at all, and we think that that is problematic at best. And what do you do when part of your claim seeks injunctive relief, and it is part of your underlying claim, but it isn't anything that would be awarded money damages that currently would be compensable? We think that that is problematic. For every case that where there would be a question about whether or not the fees were reasonable, there is an equal number of cases where fees have been entitled statutorily and have been denied. Specifically, a case in December of 2003, Dabney versus Sears Home Improvement Products, where there was significant sexual harassment, a significant award to the individual, where fees were denied. And that was a case that at least started out at the at Representative Cole's firm, where here you had significant harassment. The statute provides for the attorney's fees, and they're denied. So, I mean, it would be fair to say that if they must take it into consideration, that if it provides for it, they must also award it. But they use that discretion on behalf of the defense to balance things out and make them reasonable. And we just think that this has been the law. It generally works. I don't know the specifics of this one particular case, but I don't want to leave the committee with the impression that simply because you a statutory provision that is intended to fulfill a legislative objective allows for fees, that they are automatically awarded and that they're automatically unreasonable. I think that that is an unfair assessment of what the status of the law is in Minnesota. And if you'd consider that as you debate this, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Knobloch, I guess my question or concern might have to do with a settlement offer was made probably in the neighborhood of $10,000 in this case, but the judge isn't looking at any of the settlement offers. Why wouldn't you include the reasonableness and settlement offers that were rejected in this ratio?
Representative Nabla.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that's something that we could do. We looked at possibly rewriting the bill to set up more of a formula that said you looked at you know, what an offer was that was made. You looked at how many attorney's fees were accumulated beyond that. You looked at the difference between some final award and that offer. And I guess we thought that that was maybe too prescriptive and took too much discretion away from the judge. I guess here, you know, in regard to Mr. Carlson's statements, I think that if you've got something that has injunctive relief, you've got a different animal, that it's a little bit hard to determine what the reasonableness of the fees is. And so I don't know that that's appropriate to get into in this case. But again, here I think to have some level of reasonableness of the ratio of fees to the damage award is, I don't think, unreasonable.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, I don't know if counsel made an offer of judgment in the underlying case. Settlement discussions generally aren't viewed by the court because it discourages those very discussions, but if they made an offer of judgment in the case and subsequently the plaintiff obtained an award that was less than the offer of judgment, I don't think we're here arguing about these fees. We have a procedure in place to deal with that very instance right now, and I don't know if they made an offer of judgment or not. But if they do, as I understand, an offer of judgment, you're not entitled to statutory fees beyond the date of the offer if you do less than what the offer is at trial.
Thank you, Mr. Franz.
Yeah, I can enlighten the committee on that. Approximately 4 months before trial, the defendants collectively made an offer of $155,000 to the plaintiff, which included attorney's fees. What Mr. Carlson mentions actually relates to Minnesota Statute 54902 and its relationship with Rule 68 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. But those two provisions have to do with costs, which are normally things such as filing fees, deposition expenses, service fees, and the like. In this case, the costs of the defendants collectively rivaled the plaintiff's initial award of $10,000. I think we had $9,600 in costs. Because we made an offer, and at least from that standpoint, the plaintiff did not prevail, our costs were offset against the monetary award. What that approach does not apply to attorney's fees. Attorney's fees are a separate animal. They are within the court's discretion. I understand that over on the Senate side, Senator Tom Neville is proposing a subtly different approach that would deal with the prevailing party concept and try to treat the issue of fees in a manner similar to which costs are applied. And, you know, if the Senate deals with that, there'll have to be a conference to get it sorted out. But the issue of prevailing party does not affect or limit or stop the award of attorney's fees under the Human Rights Act.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill?
Okay.
Gentlemen, additional questions. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, you were talking about, on line 9 it says, when a statute provides for the award of attorney's fees, When it provides for the award of attorney's fees to a party that has recovered money damages, doesn't that preclude the possibility of having a zero denominator?
Madam Chairman and Representative Wardlow, you may have an instance where part of your litigation requires relief that is not monetary, and this requires. The problem that I'm trying to understand is that if the statute provides for an award of attorney's fees to a party that has recovered money damages, you could have a 363 claim that provides for attorney's fees where you prevail, but you are not that you don't recover money, and still prevail. And I'm wondering how that language interplays with the award of attorney's fees in those situations where you're advancing a particular cause, and I'm wondering why the recovery of the money damages and the statutory award of a fees is tied together. If what you're saying is, what that says to me is that I have to recover money damages to get my statutory fees, even if I'm not seeking monetary damages. And I don't think that that's what you're intending. That's how I would read it. And we're not asserting that fees should be unreasonable. We're not trying to defeat Representative Knobloch's bill, only to point out that I think that most of these are already addressed by court rules and statute, and we're creating a confusion and not a clarification.
Okay, Representative Knobloch, would you like to comment? Aren't you glad you came to civil law?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm glad I'm here now and not earlier. I guess if you're talking, Mr. Carlson, about a situation where you've got some combination of, money damages and injunctive relief, we could look at amending it by, say, just putting on page 1, line 10, after the word has, the word only. So we're only talking about recovered money damages if you wanted to get into a situation like that. But I guess otherwise, if you are in a situation where there aren't any damages of any kind awarded and you're just going to court to kind of prove that you were right, I don't know if we should, again, really be tying up the court's time all the way through like that.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Knobloch and members, there are all kinds of cases that assert our civil rights that do not have attendant money damages that are exceedingly important and are not simply tying up the court's times. I know you know that, and we're just not thinking of those right now. But I don't think that those cases where we're asserting our civil rights or challenging a statutory provision where there isn't a recovery of money damages don't have merit. I just that just doesn't follow, and I know you don't necessarily agree with that.
Well, Mr.
assessment,
Madam Chair,
Knobloch.
Mr. Carlson, I guess that's where I was suggesting. Well, I mean, if you feel like that is your main concern, we could have this with one word amended, so we only deal with a situation where there are money damages and not those sorts of cases. If the committee feels that that's an important issue.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, happy to work with Representative Knobloch as the bill moves forward to address that.
All right. Representative Knobloch, will you commit to working with Mr. Carlson and see if we can...
I will, Madam Chair.
Work this out. I sense members are somewhat uncomfortable with some of the provisions in the bill, and if you will certainly move this on, but in the meantime have discussions with Mr. Carlson, trying to address the issue, follow what happens in the Senate, how they deal with it. We've got some time here, although we're running out of energy this evening. So, any additional questions of the bill author? I have a question for Mr. Carlson.
Yeah.
Are the Lakeville boys hockey team playing Moorhead on Thursday night?
They're not. We got a break. We have my alma mater, Moorhead, playing my current home of Elk River in the first game at 7:00, and I'm a Spud at heart, so I hope they prevail.
Yep. And can you tell me who's Lakeville's playing? I got my priorities, guys.
I think they play at Centennial. I think they got a tough draw.
What?
Is it East?
Duluth East. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll take Moorhead all the way in that turn. Centennial's got a good year, but Moorhead's deep.
Madam Chair, I would commit to working with Mr. Carlson on this, if we can move this along.
All right. Thank you, members. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2002 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Mullery is back, and so I'm going to move that we take House File 2410 off the table. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we've already taken out Sections 5 and 8. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We're going to work with them over the interim. They did have a couple of legitimate concerns. Basically regarding a flag in good condition and damage to flag in good condition and damage to
common properties, and we are going to work with them on language, defining a good condition of a flag, and regarding that they'll be responsible for damage to common properties. And I believe either Dave Eide or Walter Graff will be drafting that, is my understanding. And with those, I don't have a problem with getting to those. I just want to make sure it doesn't in any way harass the homeowner who wants to fly a flag.
All right. Thank you. Members, any additional questions for Representative Mulray? Representative Mulray, is it your preference to lay this bill over or to go to the floor and do the amendment on the floor?
Just do the amendment on the floor.
Okay. And do you know if the Senate companion has been heard yet?
I don't know.
Maybe we can do a delete all to the Senate file in the meantime, and so we don't have to do it on the floor. But I will renew my motion that House File 2410 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Any additional questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Mulray. Are there any other issues to come before the committee this evening? Seeing none, the committee will reconvene tomorrow at 2:30. My hope is that we do not go past 5 or 6 o'clock. We may be maybe a little aggressive in the schedule, but if we keep things moving, we should have not quite as long of an evening. And then Friday will be a long day, there is no doubt. So with those announcements, the meeting is adjourned.